Let me call the Mesa City Council study session of Thursday, January 31st to order. We have a full agenda items today, so let's go ahead and start by reviewing the items that will be on the Monday's February 4th regular council meeting. Would like to excuse Councilmember Jones from the study session this morning, too, please. You want to grab that part of the packet? We'll go through it. It's the introduction stuff on page 1, page 2. Did have a question on 4D. Yeah, 4D. Is this is a liquor license application for Allegiant Air. Is this so they can sell on the airplane? Or how does that?
That's correct.
Okay. So they need it at this location, even though they're going to be airborne between here and Vegas and or wherever they're...
Yes, they'll need it for every airport that they're going to land in.
Okay. All right. First one I've seen, so I wanted to ask that question. All right. Anything
Mayor,
else on page 2?
4B is off consent. Club Seis Frias. They don't have their building permit issued yet. We've already extended this application once with the state, and so our recommendation is for denial until they get their building permit.
Okay, so if we concur, which I think the council probably would, can we read that in as a consent for denial, or do
yes.
we have to pull it separate?
Sure.
Unless
Mayor,
that
Mayor, we need some discussion because under the statute, you need to specifically identify the basis for the denial.
Okay, then let's just keep it off the consent. All right. Let's go on to page 3.
Mayor.
Scott.
Item 5B on T-shirts that are being used, from what I'm reading there, for recreation purposes, and I'm curious as to whether the $5 cost is actually full recovery for the printing.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, this issue came before the council some, I think, a year and a half ago, and that number was close to $150,000 to $180,000, and we took council's direction at that time to move that down to this number, and in turn, we were charging that $5 for adult sports programs to help recover that cost, and then the rest of that $30,000 or those T-shirts goes to staff to identify them at pools, recreation sites, and so forth, so that they stand out from the participants.
Does the $5 for the adults then cover at least cover the cost of
an adult
t-shirts?
Sports program? Yes.
So the youth, we're providing it for the youth. The adults are
actually, we don't provide any for the youth, only for the staff.
For the staff.
Yeah, that oversee those youth programs.
Okay, so any of the adults participating then are paying for the
for
cost of the shirt, we're getting reimbursed for that.
Right.
Okay, I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I need to pull 5C from the consent. One of the bidders on that item, even though they didn't bid it, it was considered non-responsive. I do own the property that they lease from, so let's pull 5C. It's quality emulsions. Page 4, contracts. Okay.
D, 5D will be pulled.
Read about it in the paper. What's the going to take a second look? Or?
Well, we want to make sure that there may be some information that in the report may not be accurate. So we want to make sure we can verify that.
Okay.
Off the agenda.
If it was to go out to competitive bids, are we going to check to see if there's more vendors?
I think that question was asked, and there was a determination that the vendor said there would not be any difference in the pricing.
Okay. All right. Well, let's pull it then and check it out. It's page 4, page 5. Tom.
I'd like 5J pulled from the consent agenda.
Do we have any discussion on it today? Any more information or just pull it? Okay. Okay. All right. Scott?
I'm a little ahead of myself. I'm waiting for 6.
Got it. 6.
All right. On item 6B, which is a zoning case, it's asking for a bonus intensity zone and site plan review, but I don't have a site plan. So what's the BIZ for? Are we doing a Class A office here, or are they doing a Class A office here?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, yes, that is the case. They are slightly over height on their three-story office building. You'll see that site plan when you get the
full package. And that is a Class A three-story that fits in with the neighborhood, because this isn't too far from that project we tweaked at council a couple weeks ago.
That's correct.
Okay. I'd just like to see the site plan, some more specifics on that, but that's my question. Thank you.
Okay. We have a letter, I believe, from 7A this morning.
Yes, Mayor, that is correct. As you know, the parcel 51 at Lucindus has been a topic of discussion for some time. It's been at P&Z for a couple of meetings before they voted on it, made a recommendation to you. It's on the agenda for introduction. Right now we have it set, or proposing it be for March 3rd meeting. If there's some question about that with regard to council and some of the absences from council. Also, we got a letter this morning from the applicant. We had some discussions with them yesterday. They know that staff's recommended against this. P&Z board has recommended against this. The neighbors have some issues with it. The applicant's maybe not even totally happy with the proposal at this point. So they're looking for an opportunity to work with all these groups a little bit more and have P&Z board maybe reconsider this. So the idea that we talked about yesterday is see if there's a way to agendize this for Monday for council to talk about it, to give maybe a little bit of direction to the applicant, and then send this back through the process back to council, or excuse me, back to P&Z board for some discussion and recommendation and back to council again. So want to get your feedback on that proposal, and that's basically what the letter is asking.
Right. I'm a little concerned about the precedent of having an applicant, after they've had a rendering by the P&Z, to go back to the P&Z unless there's some significant or changes that warrant that. Otherwise, they'll just go to P&Z and get their vote, and hopefully it's positive and they move forward. But if it's negative, they want to tweak it a little bit and send it back through P&Z. Well, we're trying to get kind of the best up front and not play long-term games of ping-ponging back and forth. But it goes from P&Z to council, and then if we deny it, they start the process over. We're kind of not giving them the council's feedback before that process gets started over is my concern. So I don't know if I also, the way this thing is set up with, I think Tom mentioned at the last council meeting, they're kind of in this, the staff is saying one thing for whatever reason to maintain the master plan, which is kind of what most of us indicate that we would like to do, but I'm not sure that how far staff goes in representing. But we've also expressed the same thing, that represent us well because we want to protect Gateway, and I guess this isn't a whole lot different for jobs at the Los Endes area versus the Gateway area. So that is more of a philosophical discussion on how does staff represent the council if they're going to appear before P&Z, which I think at some point we need to get into that discussion too, on whether they should or shouldn't, or what direction they really do have from council. And if they want to have a direction from council, maybe we ought to come in here and talk about it more intently first before they make a representation back to P&Z. But this one here is really unique because there's a couple of factions of neighbors, so you can't really get the feel for that. There's a HOA group I've met with, and I'm going to meet with some other neighbors here this morning. With Mr. Truitt and I are going to do that. And staff is saying we want more jobs, more retail, more office in the area, and the neighbors are thinking that, well, if it's all residential, then there won't be any conflicts. And to strike that balance is, I think, what the applicant tried to do by buffering and doing the rest, but then staff is indicating, and it doesn't match as well with our master plan, to having it as a larger job center in that whole quadrant. So the essence of that is, how do you ever get a compromise position? And I think there's also a contingent of neighbors that say, if we totally kill this thing and get it voted down, then they'll really have to come and talk to us, and then we can pretty much tell them exactly what we want and what spots. And I don't want to get to that position either. So that's our kind of a catch-22 for everybody, that under the circumstances and how this thing came down. The other one is, I'm not positive I understand the whole history of this, because I don't think it was master planned out there, but it was never zoned. So it's still like, what, R-190. R-190 is the underlying zoning, even though the master plan says it. In every other area, my understanding is they actually confirmed the master plan designation. So what are they going from? What is the entitlement? What was the expectation from this? And I'm not sure I'm perfectly clear on what that one is. So I think it needs some discussion before, with the council, to give a little input into this thing before it goes back to P&Z and the neighbors and the rest, because we're going to be the ultimate body deciding, and I don't think we've really had our two cents injected into this conversation. Tom?
Mayor, and that's exactly why I'm not concerned about the precedential value. I think this case is so unique on its facts with all the things that you just described that I don't think we can ever get to a solution if you don't get some council input up front. And so I think what we're trying to do here with the letter and what John said is to give us an opportunity on Monday night to have some of that discussion, some direction from the council, and then let the parties go back to P&Z. So I'm not concerned about that setting a bad precedent. I think it's a good idea, actually, to weigh in, because we've got our economic development people weighing in one area, we've got our staff weighing in, we've got the master plan, we've got the neighbors, we've got the developer in the middle trying to satisfy as many of those sides as he can. And the one entity that they're not hearing from is us, and we're the ones who have the final say. So to me, it makes perfect sense.
Is the intent of the letter then to hear it on Monday night to get input? Or how does that work then, if we have but not give a formal up and down vote?
Mayor, that's the general idea. City Attorney can chime in here on how we might do that. We just started discussing agenda language a little bit yesterday afternoon on how we would do that. But yes, we want to certainly don't have the material behind you to have a full hearing right after that, because it will come back to the changed item. We want to give you enough information, get some discussion, see if there is any direction the council can give as it goes back through the process, so we as staff can help work towards that direction as we work with the neighbors and the property owner and take it back to P&Z.
Okay, Vice Mayor.
Mayor, I think we have the legal authority to refer it back to the Planning and Zoning Board. We can have a vote that says, here's some conversation. And as I looked at this, item B said that solicit council comment and direction concerning council's desired land uses for the property and guidance to the applicant, staff, and the community. So I think that is what they're looking for from us, and then we can give direction from there to have it go back to P&Z. And I'm with Tom. I got to tell you, in all the years that I've looked at planning and zoning cases, and I think I'm at 10 now, I have never seen one like this. There do seem to be maybe not just 5 or 6 different positions, but maybe 20 or 30 different positions on this one.
Okay. Is the consensus then to have the meeting, hear the item, give feedback, and then make up our decision whether we want to send it back or vote on it? Or I guess we still have that option available. Well, it's just introduction, so we just be.
We're still meeting with people today and whatever, so I'm just not going to guarantee where I'll be come Monday night. And I think one of the alternatives Monday night may be to not introduce it for a future council member, but to continue it before we introduce it, just because we can continue to gather some information. I guess if we're waiting for Monday night to give council feedback, I don't know that I'm ready Monday night to give council feedback, at least not for me.
Mayor, can I? Oh, Mayor, maybe instead of putting it on the formal agenda, and this is just an option, we could put it on as a study session item, and at least then maybe council could ask questions. Maybe it wouldn't be the definitive discussion. That's just one option, or we could postpone it for another date. I was just going to try to give an option for council to have a dialogue, and maybe, because part of the question may be what information, what is council looking for also, may be helpful to gather that on Monday, maybe during a study session before the meeting. So if not, we can push it off to another date. Another study session.
Yeah, usually at the study session, the attorneys can make it, but the citizens sometimes that it's a little early.
Right. Well, and I guess the question is that the format? What format is the council looking for? I'm concerned that the council may be early on in its kind of discovery process of understanding the issues. Are you prepared to have those kind of discussions?
Good point, Scott.
I would go with the idea of a study session. I just think there's so many different opinions out there right now, and we need some more detail, I think, we're going to get then. If we, I'm not going to be ready to, well, I suppose I will be ready to give some ideas on 6B on Monday if that were necessary, but I'd prefer to have a study session. We can hear a little bit more. And I think I still have a little voice left, but not much.
And we could try to get spokespeople for both sides of that item, but I'm not, as Claudia mentioned.
I think there's at least three sides. If they were just both sides, I think we'd be okay.
Yeah, no, I was talking staff and
yeah.
Two.
Yeah, I think if you include right. The staff in there, the applicant in there, the HOA in there, the committee in there, you've probably got four sides to this.
Okay. Yes. People comfortable with study session back in that venue, Tom?
I think that's probably the best thing, and then we retain the authority even under the time that is set for introduction that we can say, okay, we can move forward with the introduction, we can refer it back to planning and zoning after we have our discussion, right?
We can do that. My only question would be, do you want to leave it on this Monday night agenda then for introduction, and then you can delete that if council during the study session chooses not to, or we bring it back for introduction in 2 weeks if council wants to move forward with introduction?
At the time of the introduction, could you just send it back? Or do you have to actually have the hearing?
You do not have to. It's not been introduced yet, so it's not even scheduled for. You're not required to have a public hearing. But if you want to have it in the study session, so it's on the study session agenda, you can accept public comment from representatives if the council chooses to, and then you can refer it back to the planning and zoning. If we leave it on the blue agenda for introduction, that gives the council, if it chooses during the study session to move forward with introduction, you can introduce it. If you remove it from the blue agenda, but during the study session council decides to introduce, it would just come back in 2 weeks for introduction. So it's whichever council wishes.
Leaving it on the formal agenda increases our flexibility. I don't think that's the option we'll end up going with, but it seems to me that there's no reason not to have it available. Why remove that as an option? It may be that the council's direction is we want to decide up and down on this proposal as it is. Then why delay 2 weeks?
Vice Mayor.
I don't disagree with that position. I just don't want to send out a message that says this is the public hearing and have everyone from Los Angeles area show up on Monday night. I mean, certainly they're welcome to come, but the public hearing, even if we chose to introduce it, the public hearing would be at a later date.
Exactly.
And, you know, from what I know now, I don't foresee introducing what we have today.
Right.
But what I'd like to see, Mayor, is at that study session, I would like a representative of each one of those groups here so that we can ask some questions.
All four sides of the box. Right.
Each one of those 20 different
moving parts.
Yeah.
I was going to try to...
Less than 20.
Okay. All right, Scott.
I think this is probably a moot point at this point, but I wanted to confirm if there happened to be a motion to approve this zoning and this site plan, is that not not a protest vote?
It is
a protest vote, right?
Yes.
So a motion to approve is a protest vote, but denial is just four straight?
Correct.
Okay. All right, I just wanted to bring that out just in case we do get to a vote on this somewhere along the line.
That's correct. All right, let's try the study session. Contact representatives from the four groups. Let's see, why don't we try to do it in 5 to 7 minutes apiece with the representatives so we can get through it and then have some time for questions, obviously. So,
Mayor, can we just be clear? I heard... four groups being the HOA, there was another group of neighbors.
HOA, the group, the neighbors that are not in favor, the HOA I believe
right.
currently is in favor, the applicant.
Yeah, okay.
And then we thought maybe
the staff
should.
Okay. The committee reference that was threw me for a second there.
Yes.
I'm with you now. Thank you.
All right. Okay. That's page 6. Page 7. Tom.
Mayor, 8A is already off the consent. Again, I just take exception to the last line of the description about enhanced municipal services. We changed that once before the last time it came up because it's not really municipal services. It's additional private services that they do. It's not services being provided by the city. So if we could maybe find a alternative sentence, I'd be more comfortable when I vote no.
I have a conflict on that one because I own property in the town center area.
Mayor, if the city attorney still feels I have a conflict on this issue, I'll declare a conflict on this issue.
Council member, how about we'll talk a little bit after the study session so I can make sure where we are.
Okay. Vice Mayor?
Does 7B have a protest on it, legal protest?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, at this time it does, although we've received some communication that indicates they're going to remove that by the time we get to the hearing.
Okay. So should it not be on the introduction if there is one?
I believe you'll see it that way on Monday.
All right. Thank you. I just noticed on both of those, I'd written a note to myself on both of those that I thought both of them had legal protests, and on the cover sheets, neither one of them stated that.
Okay. That's page 7. Page 8. Eight F is off consent. I know there's these three staff options laid out in our report. What's the intent on proceeding with that, on establishing the fees? Hourly, base fee, options?
Mayor, glad you pointed that out. We did leave that off consent because there has been some differing discussion on that. When we went to the Audit and Finance Committee, they felt that we should focus on the typical base fee and per hour fee and look at something about a 60% to 80% cost recovery. We went to P&Z. They thought we really ought to work more towards that 100% cost recovery and gave some consideration to the per hour fee instead of the base fee option. And that's what we've come back with, a base fee and per acre fee that approximates 100% cost recovery. And so knowing that really wasn't quite consistent with the recommendation of the Audit and Finance Committee, we thought the council would want to discuss it.
Okay, let's open up for discussion on this one. I've always felt closer to get cost recovery on applications, so I would probably be the Audit and Finance. I know also mentioned that that's roughly what we recover on other applications, residential and stuff, or I'm not sure what reference they were making to, and if that's the case, maybe we ought to look at those too. Would be my response back to get closer to cost recovery, because some citizens do develop and have improvements, and it costs money to run it through and do the safety checks, and others don't. So why should the ones that don't be subsidizing those that are doing construction in the city, is my take on it. So what other discussion? Obviously, there were some people in Audit and Finance that wanted to go to 60% to 80% to be even with the rest. So I guess it means you'd have to look at all your fees if you wanted to concur with my comments, but why don't we open this up? Vice Mayor.
And I think that's kind of where we were, Mayor. It was that philosophically the city has moved closer to full cost recovery, but the argument that has been made is that the entire community benefits from these services, and so that there was some measure of it that should be picked up. I think our conversation talked about moving closer, but how do you justify taking this one fee and putting it at 100% recovery without addressing all of the fees and getting them to that, you know, closer to that place? So I think our conversation, and it's been enough weeks now that I don't remember, but I think our conversation was about moving everything closer to that place.
Well, would this be the starting point then? Let's do this one and let the others catch up behind.
Mayor, can I also just weigh in? I mean, specifically, I think if the philosophy is first of all, the assumption is that we should try to get to 100%. What I think makes this fee somewhat unique is that it is very specific to a specific development. I mean, we will be working very directly and intensely with a development that is seeking for this new planned community district. And it really will take a lot more work from staff's part on the front end of the zoning process than it typically does today. So I think that's part of where we were coming from, is the effort and the direct relationship between the effort and the direct benefit to the proposal that's before us. And so maybe that's why I think we've recommended, and I think staff continues to recommend that. John, is that fair?
Yes, that is very accurate. And we would also mention that a couple of years ago you had us evaluate the cost for a major general plan amendment, and we jumped that up significantly, trying to shoot for 100% cost recovery on that. And each year over the past couple of years, as we've brought fee increases to the council, we've looked at bumping those up incrementally, and I'm looking at that currently, and will be with the budget year, trying to move closer to that with the rest of our fee structure. So we are moving in that direction.
Okay. Well, let's hear from the other council members on what philosophy are we really looking for full cost recovery, and is this the smart area to start from? And then I guess the other question would be following in on Chris, because this is the first one. Some of the groundwork that you're doing to get familiar with how to work these things through, the first person is going to pay for, and the full cost recovery on the second one is not going to be as much if there's a second one, because we'll already have a more of a process.
Mayor, that may help some, but the whole idea behind the PCD is that the applicants will get to basically propose their set of development regulations, their zoning ordinance, their engineering standards. So each one's going to be unique, and it's going to take a lot of time to look at and review and evaluate.
We may get more efficient, maybe, in how we do it. But the benefit, maybe an hourly consumption, but I think the effort, the idea is that each one is kind of customized.
Okay. All right. And then why I have a little trouble going back to an hourly rate, because it could be, depending on the efficiency of the person that gets assigned it. So I kind of like generically what it would take with the flat fee and then the per acre formulation as close to what we anticipate cost recovery to be from whatever information we can gather. So, Daryl?
That's the businessman in you saying that. And I'm going to say the staff side of it, saying it is it'll the effort will depend a lot on the material submitted and how complete it is and how responsive they are. And I've been on both sides, and I've been the applicant many, many times, and so I've heard that argument often.
All right, thanks for that comment. All right, Tom?
I'd like to get as close as full cost recovery, but I'm not sure that I want to start with just one. I think it should be a comprehensive process where we're going to get to that number rather than isolating one. And as I said at the other committee, at the audit meeting, I'm opposed to the hourly rate because there's no opportunity to fire your attorney if you don't like the efficiency with which he's working. I mean, in the private sector, you go on an hourly, but if you can review the bill, you can argue a bill, you can negotiate the bill down, and if you don't like the results, you can fire the lawyer and get another one. You don't have an opportunity here of firing the city and getting another one. So I think an hourly rate is just subject to too much potential problem. So I'd rather do the base fee, per acre fee, with an estimate as to what it's going to take to get us where we need to be.
I think I'm hearing everybody on council saying, let's not only look at this one, but let's come back as quickly as we can with the other fees that we charge to get them up to full cost recovery. So why don't we just do both? Why don't we start with this one and immediately follow through, and let's go ahead and look at what we're charging.
And the only question I have, Mayor, Council, is this is a new process. We don't have any fee. And I don't know how soon would this start. I mean, it's more of a timing issue. I think that's what it is.
Right. Mayor, we are looking at a first application for PCD coming in March. And that's why we're here now to go ahead and get this fee established so where it's in place. The applicant will know what to expect as they prepare that application. We're looking at all the rest of them in terms of the overall budget process and to have the council in June.
All right. Now, the one person I haven't heard from is the applicant. I'm sure there's a different side to this story and why we shouldn't do that or another, and I would like to have that input before I make my decision, but I'm looking for full cost recovery is the direction that I would typically head. Vice Mayor.
I think we're recreating the discussion that we had at the Audit and Finance Committee, and one of the comments that I made was we aren't talking about a whole range of entities we're working with. The only one that we have right now is DMB, and I thought that, you know, maybe we should sit down and negotiate something with them. Daryl's comments are correct. You know, there's both sides of that story, and we don't know how yet to set that fee to get to full cost recovery because we don't know what full cost is. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to be fair to them and fair to us, and maybe that conversation with them. Has anybody had that yet? It was a comment that I made in the committee meeting.
Mayor, Vice Mayor, we have kept them apprised of where we've been at in this process of the different fee proposals that we're looking at, and we are looking, trying to get it as close to cost recovery as we can. They haven't expressed any opposition to that.
And you know, I'm fine with getting to that place. It's how do we get to that place? How do we get to that number? How can somebody protest, as Tom said, if you know, how do you fire your plans reviewer? I think that they're doing it too slowly, and somebody else could do it faster or better, or you know, whatever it happens to be. So I think we're in that territory of needing to negotiate a little bit, because it isn't that I'm not okay with full cost recovery. It's that I don't know how to determine cost. And I'm married to a cost accountant, and so I've heard about cost accounting for years, but I don't know how to do it in a new realm like this.
Okay, so we have 8F on our agenda, suggestions for dealing with it. What do you want to do? I'm saying we go staff's best estimate on what cost, full cost recovery is, and establish that fee. Glad to modify it if additional information or something comes in, and also suggest that we go back and look at other fees and get them to full cost recovery. So that would be my direction this morning. Truett.
The only suggestion, kind of in the vein of what Claudia has said here, is what if they were to just chat with the applicant and the applicant said, on this one, I'm okay to do it on an hourly basis. Why would we tell them anything else if they're okay with it? And we could find that out before we have to decide on it Monday night.
Okay. That's fine to make that inquiry. As long as it gets the full cost recovery, whether it's hourly or staff's best estimate, it certainly seems like hourly would be more accurate.
If they're okay with that. And they might be, because they understand they're pioneering new territory, and any estimate that we're going to make, I would hope that we'd make it on the conservative side and make sure we recover our costs and without being too punitive to the applicants.
Right. Well, Mayor and Council, I think we would probably give an estimate. I think there should be some reconciliation at the end of the day, you know, whether it's we should be able to maybe adjust that as we go along. Maybe we could talk to the applicant about, let's give you an estimate at, you know, a certain percentage of the time, and then revisit that. But let us sit down with the applicant that we know for sure, because that's the problem. We're kind of going through new territory right now. So
I'd say bring them in.
Okay.
If we go to this type of master planning, they're pretty much a partner with the city anyway.
Right.
With the revisions that they can do then internally. Vice Mayor.
And you know, we have an opportunity here to actually have them help us develop the model that could work, and maybe it could work on some of our other fees as well. I mean, we might, because it's just one entity we're working with, we might be able to get some valuable information that we can use on other things.
Okay.
Right. But we do have to keep in mind that their own economic self-interest is to keep those fees as low as possible. So we can't be subsidizing their developments. We're going to have to get the cost recovery here.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That'd be the way to lean.
Okay. I think have the conversation with the applicant. I think the council's direction is our goal is to get to cost recovery on this type of application fees and figure out what's the easiest way to determine what that is, or to have some after the project, a final accounting that comes through with hourly versus what we anticipated. I'm not sure what the mix will be, but let's talk to the applicant and see what they would suggest, if that's okay with everyone on council. Right? Good. All right, that's page. Anything else on page 8?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Whalen.
Chief Damiani, are you available for a couple questions on the grants? As Gil's coming up, we see quite a few of these coming through each year. And we've been incredibly fortunate. I think this is about $500,000 coming to the city for emergency services. Gil, how big is the committee that votes on this, number one? How much money are we dealing with, and who has final decision as to where the money goes?
On Mayor, Councilmember Whalen, on this particular group, these items, this is the Regional UASI Committee. There are approximately 25 voting members from representative of Phoenix, Tempe, Mesa, Chandler, Glendale, and City Mesa. And again, they are representative of all the disciplines between fire, police, and emergency management as well. So the money gets distributed. There are subcommittees, prevention, training, regional response, and then also Citizens Corps and the Citizens Emergency Response Team subcommittees. So those are the groups that actually decide on where the money goes and how it's distributed among the cities.
Based on a regional plan?
It is typically the money is distributed based on its regional cooperation and how we interact with each other and for regional enhancement, regional response enhancement.
There's been some talk that this fiscal year the Phoenix area was reduced and now it's going to be increased again in the next fiscal year. Is that correct?
That is correct. We anticipate getting a little bit more money this year than we did last year. I can't tell you exactly how much it is, but it is more.
And these are directly to the State Office of Homeland Security, and they've formed the committee to disperse.
That's correct.
You know how much money we're getting in the state this year?
I can't say.
40 million?
How much?
40 million?
I really don't know, but I can find out.
It's quite a bit of money coming back into the city. I just want to make sure that people understand how it comes. We had this discussion before, mm-hmm. but just to refresh how it comes about.
That is correct. Okay. We hope it continues.
Let me do a follow-up on that. On item 8K, it indicated our report indicated $5,000 to sustain the fire department's terrorism liaison officer program. Obviously, $5,000 doesn't sustain it. $5,000 goes into helping to support. So my question, there's one officer, I believe, that one person in the fire department that's assigned to that task. So is the $5,000 used in addition to their salary to do other outside training, and is that what it's for?
Yes, Mayor, that's correct. The $5,000 is to keep that position trained. It also helps to pay for some of the annual costs for like cell phone bills and things like that.
All right, it said there's a copy of the intergovernmental agreement. I would like to request one just to take a peek at what restrictions we have then on that use of that officer. Or use of that fire department terrorism liaison officer for doing city work. Do they have to, obviously they're being paid from the city and $5,000 doesn't cover their wages, so there's a benefit to the city, but how much of it is regional work? How much of it's city work? And once you take the $5,000, can you change the proportion of city work to regional work that person does, or does the $5,000 lock them into being, quote, the regional terrorism liaison officer, and we really didn't intend that to take place for a $5,000 fee.
I understand what you're saying, Mayor, and I can get you a copy of the IGA. However, the amount of time that the TLO for fire spends outside the city is about 20 hours a week. That is what we agreed to. So the other 20 hours he spends doing normal city tasks and or functions for within his position, and then the other 20 hours he spends doing things for the region.
So why don't we have somebody suggested for that position in Tempe, pay them $5,000, and then we get 40 hours a week out of our officer, and they only get 20 out of theirs. $5,000 doesn't make up for 20 hours.
You're correct, and I will get you the IGA to see exactly how that's spelled out. Okay.
All right, Scott?
Most of the Valley cities in this mutual aid system have a terrorism liaison officer. Phoenix has six, I think, as part of their agreement. With I'm going to lose my voice, so I'll try to get through quick. With the $5,000, though, we got to make sure that money is being used either for training or supplemental. What I'm afraid of is we start using intergovernmental transfers, particularly if they're one-time transfers for salaries, and you're setting up a position. $5,000 is not a salary. But we start subsidizing that with salaries, what ends up happening once that intergovernmental transfer, that grant is gone, that position has to go away, or we're going to have to find a way to subsidize it. So we need to make sure that this is a position that we need. The purpose of this particular position is to coordinate with all the other cities and also to coordinate with police, public health, the state, the federal government, which are all problems that happened on 9/11. And the reason the federal government has been supporting this program is for that interoperability and cooperative effort so that we don't have some of those same problems we did in New York.
Mayor and Council, I think when we talk about the 20 hours away, it's not as if it's not benefiting the city. We need that liaison to understand what's happening at the regional level of coordination of response as well as the national. So it becomes a resource to the city to be tapped into those regional intelligences, national intelligences, to bring that back to MESA so that our folks understand what are the more likely threats are out there and how to prepare for them. So we see it more as a resource. Yeah, maybe the person's not necessarily in a fire department, you know, sitting there responding, but they are providing, they are a significant, it's important resource, a linkage out into coordinating with the region and the national, so we have that information to be brought back to MESA. So I think we see that as an important resource.
Okay. Vice Mayor?
Thanks. I was going to make that point, but I have a question on a different item. So if you want me to hold it, it's on the fire issue, but it's on a different one of the fire issues.
Let me ask one more question on that. Then the $250,000 on 8L, that's the same thing. It says to sustain the fire department rapid response team. I'm going under the what I know of emergency preparedness. We would be doing this anyway. So this is going to help enhance some of our communications or equipment or something else, but it's not that without this $250,000, we would still sustain a fire rapid response team. It just enhances the ability of that rapid response team to communicate and do a more effective job.
That is correct, Mayor. The team that we have in place on the rapid response group needs continual training, and this money is to sustain and actually enhance some of the equipment purchases that we have for those teams.
Yeah, and I was getting back more to what Scott was saying. It's to sustain. It means like you can never get rid of them, even if your federal funding goes away. It's like the resource officers that we put into schools. Once you put them in, boy, it's really hard to say no more federal funding, so we want to pull them out. So I want to make sure that this isn't tied into that type of program.
And I think on these rapid response teams, there's a specialized, what do we call that big piece of the piece of equipment, the rolling?
We call it the squad.
Yeah. There's a special piece of equipment that's placed in MESA for these specialty responses. And what I think through Gil and the chief, they've also worked with Homeland Security so that they understand, too, that it's important while not just let that equipment just sit there and wait for a major catastrophe disaster, but they've been able to use those on certain responses within the city anyway to get practice utilizing the equipment and things like that. So it is benefiting the community today, even when it's not necessarily a major emergency disaster.
It's used in day-to-day response. Right. That's correct.
Okay. I think the if you to support and citizen sustain would help
we
me a little bit.
Understand. We oversold that.
Okay, Vice Mayor.
You know, I think for people watching this, they may not really understand fully why you're asking these questions, because the mayor understands how important it is for us to work in the region. But we had the experience. We have had the experience in the past, and let me use the example of Clinton Cops. You get them, you hire them, they're paid for 3 years, and then, you know, they phase out their paying over the next 2 years, and you have to pick them up in your budget. And so what you have to look at with every grant is, did you now commit for the, you know, to pick something up in your regular budget? And you need to be able to look at that and see if you're making that commitment. Is that a fair assessment of what you were saying?
Exactly right.
Yeah. So it isn't, it is not irrational. I mean, if somebody's looking at that and saying, why is the mayor asking these questions? He's asking them for very good reasons, because we've had experience in you take the funds and now you have to absorb it into your regular budget. So those are, it's good questions. My question actually had to do with the CERT, and I've lost track of which one it was on.
8H.
I keep hearing that we have it, we don't have it, we do have it, we don't have it. Could you give us a status on this? And if people are interested in participating, how do they go about doing that, Gil? And this is the community emergency response teams. This is training citizens to work in conjunction with the police and fire departments on emergency issues.
Mayor, Vice Mayor Walters, you're absolutely correct. The Citizens Emergency Response Team falls under the umbrella of Citizens Corps. Currently, the state is reorganizing the way the Citizens Corps is managed. However, we still have a Citizens Emergency Response Team coordinator that is soliciting interest from interested citizens to participate in a training. It's a 21-hour training course to teach them a little bit about first aid, a little bit about organization, a little bit how the incident command system works, so that in the event of a disaster, we can solicit citizens to assist in the hopefully disaster recovery portion of an incident. They're not going to be going into burning buildings or, you know, disabling bombs or anything like that. They're going to be working at the neighborhood level to assist in...
Well, that's it, Gil. No, nobody wants to do it.
No volunteers.
No take volunteers. All the fun out of it. You had everybody excited, and now no bombs? Darn.
I apologize about that. But, again, it is a 21-hour training session that it allows people to participate at a level that they feel comfortable at.
And how do they get involved with that if they want
to? They can call the fire department base number, 2101-644-2101, to schedule a time. Now, we haven't... I got to get with my coordinator to see when the next class is. I really can't tell you when that is. But I know we will have one coming up here within the next few months.
Thank you.
Mike?
I was just going to say you get a helmet, a yellow helmet, a whistle, and a flashlight, right?
And a vest.
Okay.
Okay. All right. I think we have covered, I believe, page 8 and 9. Any other questions on those two?
I have a conflict on 9A, Mayor. Cindy Brady is a customer of my business.
Okay. Pull that one. Anything else on page 9, page 10? I know item number 11 is on our study session, so we'll cover it on that. All right. Let's go back then to study session items. Number 2 is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the Gateway Freeway Acceleration Plan. I thought Jeff Martin was supposed to do that. Who's the guy in the suit and tie?
That's right, Mayor. We not only are we making him work on his last day, but he didn't put on a tie. So, so he's really going all out. But
the Mayor,
that's right. Yeah, they're underneath. Mayor, Council, good morning. Jeff and I are here this morning to update you on the status of the information that we've found out working with ADOT through MAG and others on the possibility of accelerating State Route 802, the Williams Gateway Freeway. I know Council has expressed a lot of interest in this and frankly, long-term traffic conditions in Southeast Mesa may necessitate something like this. So we wanted to get out ahead of that per your directions and come back and report on where we are right now and get feedback from you. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Jeff, and he'll walk you through a bit of the information where we're at this point.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. Well, it's a pleasure, Mayor and Council, to be here on my final day. Getting every last minute out of me. We have been working on this proposal to potentially advance the Gateway Freeway by about 3 years. And what we're really looking at is advancing phase one, which is the first mile of the Gateway Freeway. Currently, as you can see here, the current schedule calls for the design to start in 2013 and construction in 2016. And what we're looking at is potentially accelerating the freeway to start 3 years sooner so that design would start in 2010 and construction would start in 2013. ADOT currently is working on the environmental document. We're very fortunate that the environmental document in the case of the Gateway Freeway is an environmental assessment. That generally takes about a year and a half to complete. ADOT's projecting about 2 years for completion to be conservative. An EIS would have taken 4 to 5, maybe possibly 6 years to complete, so we're very fortunate with that. The EA began several months ago, and ADOT is projecting that it will be completed in late 2009. And one of the reasons that the EA may take that long is because it includes the corridor not only in Maricopa County, but also as the corridor extends into Pinal County. Once that's finished, then design would begin in early 2010. And this first map here is from that environmental assessment that ADOT's working on. I think it's good to look at this and reflect on the fact that in terms of the environmental assessment, the ADOT is required to look at, and the community is required to look at alternative alignments, and so they are still looking at really three different corridors. As you'll recall, the Fry alignment, which is the one there to the north, is the alignment that was selected by MAG when they did their environmental overview about a year and a half ago. And we're anticipating that will very likely be the corridor that will be selected once this is finished in a couple of years. This next map shows the Gateway Freeway as it extends here in Mesa, and this map is from the freeway alignment and environmental overview study that MAG did about a year and a half ago, and this shows some of the turning movements and the basic alignment of the freeway corridor. Then this final map, this map shows the portion of the freeway that we're looking at accelerating. This is the most expensive portion of the freeway. It's the first mile, and it includes the interchange. It's a system interchange with the Santan Freeway, and that's really why this first piece is fairly expensive, because of all the turning movements associated with that system interchange. In terms of the purpose for considering this advancement, really is to provide better access to this whole gateway economic activity center. Advancing a freeway corridor typically is a tremendous boon for developing an area. We've seen that in the different areas of the city as the freeway's been extended, and we're anticipating that that would be the case in this area as well. Also, advancing the first phase of the Gateway Freeway would also serve as a stepping stone to possibly advancing the remainder of the freeway corridor, which is phase two. That currently is scheduled for construction in 2020, which is about 12 years from now. Waiting till 2020 to complete the Gateway Freeway is going to present a number of traffic problems for the community. The traffic from Pinal County is projected to continue to increase over time. It's already an issue. It's going to get worse. And this traffic will either cross through the city on our city streets, or it can traverse the city through the different freeway corridors. Problem with this, if the freeway is not accelerated, then our city streets will have to handle this, and the capacity is just not there to handle that level of traffic volume. We've also been looking at cost estimates for doing this. The first phase of the Gateway Freeway is estimated to cost about $175 million. That's in year of expenditure dollars. It's important to understand that these are really planning level figures that we're looking at right now, because there really hasn't been very much design done. I think they're about maybe less than 10% design level right now. And so there's a good chance that these numbers are going to change over time. And for that reason, ADOT's been very conservative with projections, and they've been adding in a number of contingency factors just in case. Advancing these funds 3 years would cost about $33.5 million in interest expenses. As you probably know, there's our stand monies that have been set aside for this corridor for right-of-way protection that total about $20.3 million. One aspect of this proposal would be to take that $20 million of stand funds and apply that to this acceleration, and that would reduce our interest expense to a little over $13 million, which would then be split between the city and MAG. MAG has a freeway acceleration policy where they recognize that accelerating a freeway is a tremendous savings to the system, because you're acquiring the right-of-way sooner, you're doing the construction much sooner, and there's a tremendous savings associated with that. And so they share in the interest expense to do the corridor sooner. The other item I think to remember is that the interest expense is paid over about a three-year period during the time frame that the project is designed, right-of-way is acquired, and construction takes place. So it's not paid out over a single year. In terms of next steps, we're here to request some council direction on this concept of continuing to work with the legislature and MAG and ADOT. There's a number of hoops that we have to jump through to do this project. Scott and I are going down to the state legislature as soon as we're done here to testify on the highway project advancement note legislation that's been introduced. It's being heard in Andy Biggs' committee, Representative Andy Biggs' committee in the House. And that's one of the one aspect that we'll need to get passed by the legislature to increase the amount of highway project advancement notes that can be issued because of the size of this project. There's also the potential need for legislative approval to use the stand funds for the interest expense. We'll also need MAG and ADOT board approval to use the stand funds for the interest expense. So there's a number of hoops for us to jump through. We're probably looking at about a year process to get to the point where we would be ready to actually do something in terms of financing, because we'll also need to do an intergovernmental agreement with ADOT. So that's kind of those are the next steps, and that's kind of the plan that we're looking at. And what we really wanted to do was to lay out what these costs are, what we're looking at doing, and get some direction from council as to whether or not you're supportive of continuing to follow this process. And with that, Scott and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Where do you get the $6 million from?
Well, you know, as you know, in transportation, we have a very detailed five-year and 20-year transportation improvement plan, which includes all of our costs over the next 20 years, 5 years and 20 years. And we do have a fairly healthy amount of funds that we're holding in contingency. Some of those funds are being held for the election that's coming up, potential election that's coming up in November on the street bonds. But we do have funds that we have not earmarked for expenditure yet, and that we could take these funds and potentially use them for this acceleration. And it might be that there may be some projects that we might have to defer, some maintenance that we might not do in order to accommodate this and defer that maintenance for a couple of years.
Okay. Mayor, if I could also add as well, we're also going to actively work through the federal process. There's really two different ways. There's discretionary money, above the line money that can be used for items such as this, and there's also the reauthorization of the Surface Transportation Act that's going to be coming before Congress in the next couple of years. And this is certainly one item that we would like to work with our partners in D.C. to see if there may be additional funding for. So not only at the local level are we looking, but also at the federal level. We don't have the exact way to do that, but also, Mayor, just remember that $6.5 million is over a three-year period. So,
and Mayor, I would suggest that there's not any way we could contemplate considering this project if we don't have the bonds approved in November. Because then that means is the cash that's available from the sales tax that we collect for streets would all have to go into maintenance and city share and just everyday capital improvements in the existing system. Without being able to address new capacity, new infrastructure in the future, we wouldn't be able to go forward. So, but it does also allow us to look at it over a three-year period and not one large lump sum payment. So,
so the portion in the November that the 400 and some million, forgot exactly what that total number is, there's some contingency money in there in the street portion that would be...
Well, I don't know what, I don't want to consider it contingency. Maybe Brian can help me out here. Is what I'm what I would suggest is, though, if the bonds aren't approved and we don't have all the dollars that we'll absolutely need, we'll have to go to existing infrastructure and keeping up with those things. We won't have any capacity to take on new projects like this.
Well, that's what I was asking, because I don't think it was part of the roll-up originally to put this acceleration money in that bond.
Correct.
And correct. I probably would have had it been right. mentioned, because that's how we did the widening of US 60 several sure. years in advance.
And Mayor, you're correct. It's not in the roll-up of the bond program we're looking at now, because our commitment, again, as Jeff outlined, the stand monies would be used to pay the interest costs up front. Our $6.3 million would not come until the final portion of that interest payoff, and I believe that would be the 3 years starting in 2013, which is outside the current five-year program that we're looking at now.
So it would give us time. I think what we've said is it would give us time over the next 5 years or so to begin if we decide to move forward. And there's still a lot of questions and effort has to be made, but it would give us some period of time, 5 years or so, to start reserving some contingencies to meet these obligations in the future. My point is, if we don't have the opportunity to do larger projects through bonds, we won't have any capacity to set aside dollars in those out years. That's kind of where I'm trying to come from.
I just didn't want to get into the I-10 West Side issue where they wanted the acceleration, but they didn't really plan on appropriating the money.
Right.
We need to plan on it. If we get something else that supplements it, fine. But
I'm assuming the $175 million is based on the accelerated schedule?
Yes, it is.
What's the estimate if it's not accelerated?
Well, the estimate if it's not accelerated really is in current year dollars, it's $146.9 million.
Have you done the year of expenditure analysis?
Yes.
We've inflated
the estimate that we got from ADOT, which was $147 million, 2 year of expenditure costs.
I think what the council is asking for is if we didn't accelerate, what would be those same apples-to-apples comparison costs?
Year.
The reason we're doing this, we're accelerating it to also mitigate against future construction inflation.
Right.
So what's the premium of a 175 out in the future, and it's and maybe Beth can tell us what the inflation construction factor is on projects today. I mean, compounded times three, I guess, is what it would be. I don't know. Do you have that, Jeff?
No, we don't. And Councilmember Ross, we'll get that number for you. We've gone through several iterations. In fact, we're on the third iteration of this project with ADOT, because it is kind of at a planning level right now. So the costs have come down, and we haven't run that analysis on the new number that we got from ADOT just about a week or two ago. We'll get that number. But,
yeah, I just want to be able to – there's got to be a benefit to accelerating, and there's no reason to incur the $33 million in interest expense.
Right.
And, quite a bit higher.
All right. And then secondly, what if we can't use the stand funds to pay the interest?
Mm-hmm. We couldn't do the
project. Is there still a benefit to accelerating?
The cost outweigh the benefit. Yeah.
The cost would outweigh the benefit.
Yes, because the
so we're at least estimating that whatever that number is, we don't know. It's not going to be bigger than $33.4 million.
Without the twenty $20 million, if it's not available for interest costs, and it only goes into project costs, which like it is today, and actually today it's being considered for a right-of-way purchase.
Right.
Then it really doesn't make this acceleration feasible for the city.
I just wanted to know whether it was something we would do anyway, because the benefit was so great.
No,
so
at that point it doesn't. The number gets
too large. I'd like to see the number, yeah. But I think the idea of continuing to explore the concept is worthy and should be pursued.
Thank you.
Okay, Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. I think we should pursue it as well. I was going to ask that question, too, but you don't have the answer to it, so I won't ask it again. But do you recall, Jeff, mm-hmm. how much we saved by accelerating, how much we saved, you know, for the region? Because, after all, we're all taxpayers, whether we pay taxes into the city of Mesa or into the county or into the state. How much did we save by accelerating the freeways that we accelerated?
The previous three that we did?
Yes.
I don't know off the top of my head. It's always quite a bit of money. It's usually per freeway about $10 million. The other accelerations were smaller. They were only for a year and a half, so it wasn't anywhere near as significant as this one.
But most of us think $10 million is a significant number.
Yes.
Yeah. And since it is your last day here, I won't give you a really hard time over the fact that you're probably wearing that tie to go down to the legislature not to be here.
No. Oh, no. I wore this just to come here.
But I do want to point out, if the citizens of Mesa see Jeff on the street, they really ought to thank him, because when we're talking about those $10 million savings and, you know, three times over, so maybe we're talking about $30 million savings. Jeff was one of the architects of that plan that's now being used all over the state. It was a great plan that was looked at to help accelerate the freeways, but what it ended up doing in addition to accelerating the freeways was saving the taxpayers a lot of money. And so on behalf of everyone, Jeff, I want to thank you, but I think the residents of Mesa should know how much they need to thank you for.
Thank you. Okay. Appreciate that.
I think I'm getting the feeling that let's move forward if there's some hurdles in it. I know that when the stand money was set aside, my intent was to make sure that Mesa received an allocation of it, and that it was for a pending industrial development that was going in, that if we didn't buy the land, they're going to build the buildings, and then we would have to buy the land and the buildings. Right. And I assume that's been resolved, or ADOT's going to be acquiring that right away before the buildings are constructed, so we don't have that same issue?
Mayor, we're currently working right now with ADOT and the property owner, and they've been very accommodating with us, because one of the things we're asking through this process is, instead of using the right-of-way money to acquire a single parcel, that if you spread it out and apply it towards the interest payments, you're able to not only buy that parcel through the normal right-of-way acquisition process, but other parcels as well. So ADOT has been in discussion with the property owner, and we appreciate their willingness to allow this conversation to come forward and to work with council. I think they're here today, and they're just watching the process to see how this may transpire, because obviously they have some property and interest here.
Okay. Well, I think you've got the concurrence that if you can put all the pieces together, let's try to work on the acceleration. Right.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And congratulations on your service and retirement, Jeff.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Number three is hear a presentation and discuss the South Mountain multi-use path. Path Canal. South Canal.
South Canal.
Yeah, we're not going over there.
Yeah, we're not going to South
right.
Mountain.
That's,
South Mountain Freeway.
South Canal, multi-use.
I'm going to tunnel through it.
There's got to be something Freudian in there. That's my next one. Yeah.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Dan Clevenger from the Transportation Department. With me on the outsides, we have staff from Engineering, Kelly Jensen, Glenn Gorky. Mike James will be doing the bulk of the presentation this morning. I think most, if not all, the Council is familiar with the proposed South Canal project. I think we were here about a year ago, January 2007. This is a two-mile-long project along the in the Lehigh area's unimproved canal banks between McKellips and McDowell. And the intent of this project was to provide a facility for equestrians, bicyclists, walkers, joggers, rollerbladers, etc. And the intent of this project really is to be a part of a regional network. So although it's a two-mile section kind of in the heart of Lehigh, the intent is to connect further east to Granite Reef Dam, which would provide about an eight-mile-long section with no grade-separated crossings along that entire section. Would also connect to other improvements in the future along canal paths within Mesa and our neighbors in Tempe, Chandler, and Gilbert. Obviously, we don't have the resources to connect and build this network all at one time, so by necessity, we need to do this incrementally. This project's been on hold since last January, basically. I believe at that council meeting, we heard from a lot of folks for and against this project. You'll recall that there was an initial vote to move forward on the project, and we had some additional comments from some of the residents. And, let me back up just a second. The vote was to move forward without lights at that time. And then after hearing some comments from some folks, there was a revote. We basically kind of put this on hold to investigate a little more and try to work with the community and ADOT to see if we can come up with some compromises. We've met with those folks, we've come up with some compromises, and I think there was a little bit of a misunderstanding at that council meeting on where exactly the equestrian portion of the facility would be, their space. I think Mike will resolve that, and we'll clear that up today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mike to start the presentation.
All right. Thank you, Dan. A lot of the information, for some of you, you've been through this, but we just want to provide an update and go over a little bit of the introduction and background information. As I've presented in the past, back in 2002 with the transportation plan, we identified goals to develop a network of shared use or multi-use paths throughout the city and the region. And in 2005, the city actually did go ahead and put together a map of where those canal banks are and what that system would look like. And that's on the next slide I'll get to. You know, really the vision, as Dan mentioned, and I'll just hit it again, it's a citywide and a regional network. In fact, Valley Forward, one of the premier local environmental groups, has developed what they call the pedestrian freeway. And all of these South Canal projects are a critical link in that pedestrian freeway for the region. And Dan has said, we wish we could build this whole system, but like a freeway, you got to build one piece at a time and keep on cranking over the years. Here's the map that the city developed. You can see we're blessed with several canal banks that provide good access throughout the city and the region, connections with Gilbert and Tempe. And, you know, over the year that I've been working on this project, people have asked, why the South Canal? There's a lot of other canals out there. And Dan hit on a little bit. You know, it's that advanced planning that we did with ADOT to put in those grade-separated underpasses. That's critical. For why this was prioritized. It's a safety issue, it's a comfort issue, and it's an amenity issue that's really nice to have in a transportation system such as this. Also, I think this is an important project because we do have construction funding for phase two, which extends from McDowell north to Val Vista. So what we do here will pretty much set the tone for that next piece. Here you can see the entire South Canal shared use path as we've broken into phase. You can see phase one in red, phase two in the purple color, eventually phase three that will link with the Lehigh Historic Path that we are currently and continuing to work on, and eventually working all the way up to the Granite Reef Dam.
You have a question.
Yes.
I have a question about about something on the on that map and a comment that was made. You said that there were no that every crossing was a grade separated crossing, but I'm looking at this map and McKellips Road, the crossing there, that's not a grade separated crossing.
No, starting north at McKellips all the way to Granite Reef Dam.
Okay, so from north of McKellips,
yes.
You're saying it's grade separated. Okay,
yes.
Just wanted to clarify
yes.
that.
In fact, we.
I thought maybe there was some mysterious bridge I didn't know about.
No.
All right.
Not that I know of either. So what we're asking and what we're doing on Monday night, we're going to be asking for council direction on this project. And we were directed to kind of go through the presentation and go through the background, the design refinements, recommendations here today so we could have the discussion, anticipating that we will have significant public input on the project. Just going back, around 2000, we were awarded $1.5 million CMAQ grant for design and construction. This was to cover approximately 94-95% of the entire project. So very high level of contribution leverage on the project. Starting later that year, the first outreach meetings were held, and there was a project advisory committee that was formed that included Lehigh residents, equestrian interests, bicyclists, some of the neighbors from the other neighborhoods besides Lehigh. And they came up with three recommendations. I think it's important to bring those forward. The first recommendation was to not build a concrete path, but make it asphalt because it was a better surface for equestrians if they were to have to ride on that surface. To lower the lights, they didn't want big street light lights. They wanted shorter pedestrian scaled lights that were 14 to 15 feet high. And the other one, which goes back to the point that Dan was talking about, was to move the equestrians away from the canal. Initially, I think the design had the equestrians next to the canal waters, and they said, no, we don't. That does not make sense. Let's put the path between the water and the equestrians. And that's always been the design as we've moved forward since that point. Between 02 and 06, we received several letters of concern and petitions against the project. There was some concern because some people thought the canal was actually going to be built on the consolidated canal, not the South Canal, so we straightened that out. And in that time, we spent about $200,000 on design. So we were moving forward, trying to address the issues that came up. You probably all remember the concerns. I'll hit them quickly. The pedestrian lights impacting the neighborhood was an impact. The potential conflicts with equestrians and other users was an issue. Increased motorized vehicles, ATVs, that type of use on the path was a concern. The neighbors adjacent to the concern were also brought up the issue of parking and where are people going to park. They were concerned about that. There was an issue about the ability to view adjacent yards, particularly those yards that were on the lower side of the north side of the canal, and then increased crime with the development of the facilities. While we did get a lot of people opposed to the project, there were also a good segment of those people that were just opposed to the lighting. So, you know, there were several letters that we got that said, you know, if you take out the lighting, we're okay with the project. We also did receive some letters of support for the project. Some of those indicated that, you know, this is something that benefits the entire city, not just a specific area of the city. Horses are rarely present in the canal north of McDowell. You know, there was some indication that pedestrian lights could increase safety and security in the area. Some users would prefer a paved path. You know, gates could be installed to prevent the ATVs up there. And the pavement would be good to improve the dust in the area. So moving forward, there was a public meeting held October 3rd of 06. At that time, citizens suggested that the lights should be on timers. That really came out of that. Unfortunately, because of a scheduling snafu, we also took an IGA to council that would allow us to construct on the canal. So we actually went back to the transportation committee at that time to get some feedback. And at that time, there was a recommendation to remove the pedestrian lighting and retain the asphalt surface, which is consistent with the staff recommendation that you'll see here in a bit. The situation Dan talked about on January 22nd last year, the council approved and then rescinded the approval. Well, you know, we've got to give the citizens some credit there. They did incorrectly believe that we were saying the equestrians had to walk right next to the water in a 3 to 5 foot space. And under that situation, if I believe that, you know, horses could fall into the water. However, that's not the case. And as we'll talk about, we have always, the design and sense since 2002 was to move those horses away from the canal side. So at that time, the council directed us to revise our plans, which we did, and again meet with the Lehigh leaders. We did that on March 20th, and we presented our revised improvements with the refinements that allowed more space for the equestrian users. And we had a very nice meeting with the group, and the result of that was a letter from the Lehigh group identifying that, yes, while we may have addressed several of the equestrian issues, they were still philosophically opposed to the project. So last summer, we went to the Transportation Infrastructure Committee and really didn't have a solution that worked with the neighborhood, or so we basically put the project on hold, which leads us to where we are today. One of the things that we wanted to do with you is specifically talk about some of the design refinements that engineering has done, and I'll hand that back to Dan.
Thanks, Mike. I'll just go over some of the design refinements and talk to you about the compromises we've made. We've had a few different iterations on this project, and I don't know if we called attention to it, but the boards are behind you. You can see those some of the pinch points we have in red. There's just a handful of them now. We were able to, I think, originally in the first design I saw, the path didn't parallel the canal. It kind of was placed conveniently. In some places, I think it was 8 and 9 feet away from the canal. Then there was an iteration where we paralleled the path for 5 feet away from the canal. The remaining area was for the equestrians. What we've done now in those pinch point areas, we've moved that path to within 3 feet, and we think that's as close as we can safely get. So we moved that to within 3 feet of the canal. We have narrowed our path from where needed down to 7 feet. The optimal best design would be recommended at 12 feet. The majority of our path we'll still be able to get in at 10 feet, but in very rare cases we've gone down to 7 just to share that space with the equestrians. We've been able to provide them 4 feet or more, in many cases up to 15 and 20 feet for equestrians. So the path was shifted to within 3 feet of the canal bank. You'll see now that we site 363 feet, so we only have 363 feet worth of pinch points where an equestrian may have to, for a brief period, walk on an asphalt surface, and then immediately after that, they're able to get back onto their natural surface that they prefer to walk on. You'll see the average width of the canal bank from in the three different segments, from McAllops to Gilbert, the average width is over 30 feet. That provides over 15 feet for the average equestrian use along that section. There's also the segment then between Gilbert and McDowell. That's even wider. That provides over 37 feet shared, keeping in mind that approximately 15 feet is taken up by the path. So it's 5 feet from the canal, 10 feet for the path, and that gets narrower as needed. So the average width then of the equestrian for equestrian use in that area is over 22 feet. The last segment's a little shorter, but still quite wide, 30 feet shared space for equestrians and other shared use path users. A bullet point there, the Gilbert Road underpass. There are two underpasses that are on this segment, and there's a third I like to call attention to at Val Vista, which is not operational right now. It's filled in, but that's another at grade, or not at grade, it's grade separated crossing, goes under Val Vista. But the these two underpasses are concrete right now. I think it's a heavily tined concrete section that the horses already walk on, and that entails about a total of 1,000 feet between those two. One is shared use space of 20 feet. That's the Gilbert Road underpass. McDowell has about 12 feet shared use space to get through that tunnel, if you will. So Compared to what's out there already being used, there's 1,000 feet of concrete being used by equestrians. With our compromises and the way we've been able to shift the path to the canal and narrow it in sections to provide maximum equestrian space, there's only additional 360-some feet where the equestrians may have to be on asphalt. So kind of in a nutshell then, our compromises, we've agreed at one point to eliminate the pedestrian lighting. That seems to have gone over pretty well with the community. We've shifted from what was originally, very early in the process, planned to be a concrete surface, has changed to an asphalt surface for the path. The path width we've reduced from basically 10 to 8 to 7 in some spots, and it's just a very few spots. I just think one or two that go down to 7 feet with this current design. And again, we've shifted that canal path as close as we can comfortably get to the canal bank or canal itself, just to provide maximum equestrian space. So back to Mike.
Okay, with that, we just jump into our recommendations for the different alternatives. And we're really presenting three, just so you can have you can see the range of what we've looked at over the time. The first alternative, which is our staff recommendation, is to construct the facility with the asphalt paving and to eliminate the pedestrian lighting. You can see that our local construction cost share is $56,000, and the O&M cost is $6,500 per year per mile. So that's consistent with the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee recommendation that we had last year. Alternative two, which is is the exact same design, but would include the lights. So this, we're not recommending this, but just wanted to show you the cost. The local share cost $92,400, O&M cost $8,000 per year per mile. The other alternative that we looked at was eliminating the project. The local cost to refund the design that we would have to give back would be $249,200. Of this, $155,000 is not currently funded. So one of the reasons we're looking at this now as we're going through the budget season is that we would have to find this $155,000 to refund the region. Of course, Mesa could compete with the other Valley cities for a portion of this refunded money. It would basically go back into the MAG pot. Yes, Claudia.
So my question is, back in 2002, when this was voted on to take the money and do the design, at that point in time, it's kind of like the question that the mayor had before on the accepting grant funding. At that point in time, we were committed to either building the project or having to refund the money. So when we voted, like October of 2006, the die was already cast in terms of the design money. Wherever we were, if we voted no on that, we were going to have to give the design money back. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that is correct.
So once the design stuff went ahead in 2002, we were committed to either build and keep that design money or have to repay it.
Correct.
That's probably one of those conversations that should be had every time there's something like this that comes forward, because I know we ask. We say things like, now, does this commit us to future dollars? How does this tie our hands? But that's one of those things that people should really be aware of when they vote. And you're going to have a whole bunch of new council members in a few months. And it's one of those questions. I see two of the candidates sitting in the audience today. It's one of those questions that you should always ask. What does it mean when you take grant funding? Thank you.
Thank you. Just continuing, the fiscal impacts really just mimic the alternatives. As I mentioned earlier, to build the asphalt facility with no lights, excluding the lights, local construction share $56,000, O&M of $6,500 per year per mile. You can see that the increased cost with the lights, a local share $92,400, O&M is higher because you're maintaining the lights, $6,000 per year per mile. Alternative three, eliminating the project. We would refund the $249,200 in design costs that we have spent to date, and we'd have to find another $155,000 that are that are not designated currently. Again, as I mentioned earlier, this may influence phase two moving ahead. If we were to not do that project, we'd have an additional $106,000 that we would need to refund as well. So with that, we would open up for discussions or questions on the project, realizing that we're moving towards a council direction on Monday night.
Vice Mayor.
Okay, I have a bunch of questions. First of all, are all parts of the pedestrian freeway paved? Somebody used the term pedestrian freeway to talk about the whole, was that you, Mike?
Yes, it was. What they've done on their map is they identified currently paved facilities, funded facilities, and then future, you know, opportunity. So they kind of have three phases.
It's my understanding that there are sections in Phoenix that are not paved and that they are not intending to pave.
That is true. There's a lot of facilities that that are unpaved and they're not planned to be paved. There's others that have paving on one side, particularly in Scottsdale. They'll pave one side and leave one side unpaved.
What's SRP's situation here? Because a conversation I had last year indicated to me that their preference is for they don't want paving on the canal path. Is that, have you had a conversation with them any time recently?
Sure, I can take that one. One thing that hasn't been pointed out here, this is U.S. government property. It's operated and maintained by SRP. They actually have a program. They don't have a lot of funding for it, but they have a program at SRP is for dust control, air quality issues that they are paving themselves. So they are partners with us. We have an agreement with them. We can move forward with this project if we get the council's blessing. That's the first I've heard that they don't want paving on their canals because they're actually doing that some themselves.
Dan, when's the last time you talked to them about that? Because I had that conversation within the last year, and it sounded like they were heading in a different direction.
And Vice Mayor, I followed up from that conversation and found out that was the comment that was given to you was an error because we actually do have a signed agreement. The spokesperson, I think, didn't realize that SRP had actually signed off and agreed to the terms of this path.
And in terms of their current policy, you don't know. They weren't talking about their current policy. They were talking about whether or not.
Well, and
I guess you're right. That was the other piece of it. They didn't know that we had a signed agreement.
Yeah, and they didn't realize. And then I think the other part of their business in SRP, it actually encourages the way to manage dust control. And they saw this as a positive thing. And it also allows them to get into due maintenance.
I can tell you, having talked with various different people at SRP, that apparently there is not one voice on this. That's because I've heard different people have told me different things. The other thing is that I just wanted to, and I went back and asked Mark Freeman to make sure that I was not misstating this. Their concern, the Lehigh leaders' concern, is not a philosophical concern. They may have stated a philosophical position, but their concern is they have safety concerns and equestrian use concerns. And on Monday night, I just want the rest of the council to be aware of this because I think the mayor's office is aware of it, but they are bringing an expert by the name of Jan Hancock, who apparently consults with the region on equestrian uses. And she'll be here to discuss, she's looked at this and what her concerns are with it. So I just wanted everybody to be aware of that. They asked whether they should have her here today or bring her on Monday night, and the response back from the mayor's office would be better for her to come on Monday.
Right. Mayor and Vice Mayor, we actually invited Jan Hancock to get involved in this process. It was Mitch Foy who invited her because we wanted her feedback because we'll admit here we are not equestrians, anybody that I'm aware of really in transportation. So we wanted to get that kind of input to do the right thing. She had some concerns with the design. I think she agreed that these were some good changes, the compromises we made. I think the agreement was the best, you know, as much room as you can give the equestrians and the natural surface is best for them. I think that's agreed upon, and I think we'll agree with that too. But what we're looking at here on that whole path, which is 30 to 35 feet, we're trying to provide room for everybody to have their space and utilize it in the manner in which they would like to.
I just wanted to make everybody aware of that she's going to come. I haven't spoken with her, so I don't know what her comments are going to be, but she is going to be coming to talk about it.
Okay. Scott?
Dan, can you tell me the areas in Phoenix or other cities that are not paved and are not intended to be paved? where are they? How do they connect with the paved sections? Are there alternative routes that are connecting to these? Are they part of the entire plan? Why are they not paved? There's about four questions there.
Yeah,
Pick one.
I'll try to address that. Really, in going through, Meg has a pedestrian committee. And really the way that the process works is each of the cities each year can submit a project. And depending on the scale and scope of the projects, really all you really can ask for nowadays is basically funding for one segment of a trail, which could be anywhere from 1 to 2 miles, depending on what you're gonna build. Talking from the city of Phoenix, which I'm most probably familiar with, they just have so many miles of canal that some in the northern areas adjacent to equestrian areas, they just have decided that they're not going to pave those, and they're prioritizing their efforts in more urbanized areas. So I think that's one of the reasons why some are identified and not.
So those areas, just to repeat it, are up in the northern part of the city as opposed to in the central areas where they'll be,
sure,
be utilized. And now those paths will all these paths will connect, so folks can go from downtown Phoenix through Tempe, out Mesa, and up to the dam?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, even the county has a plan that really is a circulation ring path connecting all of these so that you can access all the regional parks.
And if this plan is built to completion with all the sections being done, there will be a contiguous pathway. There won't be broken sections of asphalt, dirt type of look. It'll all be that combination.
That's really the vision. Now, it would take 100 years or more to get there just because of the numbers of miles that we have out there. But that's the vision.
100 years or more to get, sure, to the whole thing?
Sure, yeah.
Which brings, actually, that kind of brings up this other question I had, too, that's just kind of interesting. So that there are areas that are funded now, and there are areas that are planned to be funded in the future. And what is that funding contingent upon? Is that a federal government funding, or how sure are we that
it's CMAQ
this
funding.
Project, CMAQ funding, how sure are we that this project will be continued for 100 years, as you said, tongue in cheek, I hope, but how sure are we of that funding source? Because I'd hate to put in a section that we're responsible for and then the funding drops out and we never complete the project.
Yeah, and it's really goes along with reauthorization of the Surface Transportation Act the federal government puts in. They put in firewalls that this money cannot be used for freeways or streets. They typically, every year, they'll designate a certain amount of funding for the regions for bike and pedestrian improvements. You know, every 6 years when that's reauthorized, we kind of see where how much money there is and whether it's going to be continued. So, that's kind of how the funding comes down.
And if I can add on to that as well, our intent is to build on what has begun. So it wouldn't make much sense to hopscotch around the city and do 1 and 2 mile pieces all over. We'd like to continue building. I think our priority would probably become the South Canal, if this piece moves forward, to get a nice piece together, a nice, useful, 4, 6, 8 mile piece, and continue building off that so we provide that regional connectivity. But each piece that's added makes, I think, that pathway more desirable, more useful, more beneficial.
Right. And you mentioned that this money was, in a way, earmarked for pedestrian-friendly. What other restrictions on the use? What can we spend this money on? What can we not?
Really bike and pedestrian improvements. So, for example, you can do on-street bike lanes, you can do sidewalk improvements, you can do pedestrian bridges, you can do pedestrian rest stops, you can do shared use paths.
Which is what this is,
yeah.
Right. But what about planning or... We talk about pedestrian-friendly sidewalks. What about shade screens, plantings, anything along? Can we do trees along here to help buffer some of this,
yeah,
lighting?
Yeah, you can include landscaping as part of the project. We haven't on this piece. There's actually, for large segments, it's heavily treed, actually, on the north side.
Because there's some areas on this, if anybody's familiar with it, that you have the canal on one side, and then the bank is, that's a big bank. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a cliff, more than the bank. So we could do plantings along there that might help with stabilization, but also screening for the neighbors that are down below. Could we add that to this?
Yes, we could, if that was your direction.
Interesting. I didn't think we could do that from before. Thank you.
Okay, other comments? Tom?
A question to clarify one aspect of it. CMAQ money is basically traffic mitigation money.
Congestion mitigation, air quality.
Congestion mitigation. So the concept behind this is if we build these, it'll actually start competing with light rail because people will prefer to bike and run to work rather than taking the light rail or drive their car.
I would suggest it would complement, not compete.
Complement, yeah. But the whole concept is we're trying to reduce congestion on the streets.
And air quality impacts, yes.
And air quality. But the air quality impacts come from having less cars on the streets.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mike?
What's the future plan for the connection at McKellips to avoid injury? Is it flashing lights? Is it a pedestrian bridge?
Sure. Councilmember Whalen. We have a standard treatment we use. You've seen these on Horn
and
Mesa Drive, Brown, Stapley. We have a raised median refuge area that we use in advance of that. I've got pictures if anybody wants to see. I could pop it up on Elmo. In advance of that, we have bright fluorescent yellow-green warning signs at trail crossing. That's our basic treatment. As these paths get more utilized and demand warrants it, that can be stepped up to a flashing light system all the way up to a full-blown pedestrian-actuated traffic signal if we had that much demand. And that's kind of the typical treatment. These have worked very well, those pedestrian refuges, and we would intend as, for example, on McKellips, for those users going south, if that section were built, it'd be at that time, not that we couldn't do it earlier, but at that time I'd propose that we build a refuge area on McKellips as well for that connectivity to help people cross in two stages. So you only have to look one direction of traffic. You get to the middle, you wait for your next gap, and then you cross.
How and where would the crossing be in relation to the light at Stapley it'd be Stapley Caddy Corner, right?
That's correct. It's several hundred feet away. So it wouldn't be that convenient for them to ride their bike down the sidewalk and cross at Stapley and come back.
And your speeds in that area are relatively high, so you've got a wider street and a lot more traffic volume.
Yes, and that is the difference on this one. This is 6 or 7 lanes wide, including the two-way left turn lane. Speed limit's 45 miles per hour, which is typical arterial 40 and 45. But we still think this crossing can be made safely by crossing in two stages. So you cross 3 lanes of traffic, 33 feet. You choose your gap. You get to the middle. You wait for that break in traffic again. Then you cross the remainder. The other locations where we have these raised medians, those are 5-lane streets, and they're working well, and I don't see why it couldn't work on a 7. Yes, it's a little longer crossing distance, but we think that can work well.
And then your future project to tie into the south, how many years out is that forecasted?
It's in our plan. We haven't identified a year. The soonest we could do it would be 2012 based on, if we were to get matching funds like we've done on this project.
And where would that intersect with the current path?
You could go back to your plan.
Yeah. I'll go, yeah. Yeah, just west of Horn. That
where the confluence is?
Yeah, where it would go down to the confluence, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Let me make a couple comments. I've been in favor of trying to have some vision for Mesa with the Vashalayok Mill, river restoration. Obviously, we're not doing we have some parklands, but we're not doing as many parks as we used to in the past because of the ongoing maintenance. The maintenance cost on these is not near what it takes to mow a whole section of a park area and do all that maintenance. And I really think that the vision for Mesa at build-out with the canal system that we have and having that as a secondary way to do small trips, whether you ride your bike or whether you're out hiking or biking or doing something else. It just promotes the quality of life for the community. And I would hate to see this one gap placed in there and not be able to get out to that Granite Reef Diversion Dam. That is gorgeous country. When I was training doing triathlons, I'd run out there, and it is, sometimes you can actually feel and enjoy the beauty of the view instead of the pain that you're suffering from the running. So it is distracting. It's that nice. And you're right, there's some old trees along that bank, and there's some very, very pretty places that I think that the citizens of Mesa, with the connectivity that the county has to their parks and some of the other big loops that are present in the valley, I think we would be remiss in not moving forward. I appreciate all the work you've done to try to accommodate the equestrian, and it sounds like that's been pretty successful. Obviously, if they can go 1,000 feet on concrete through underpasses, the 300 foot of choke points and stuff that you've identified shouldn't be a major obstacle. So I appreciate you the work you've done. I thought this was a go-ahead that we were into as this type of matching money came forward, we would use it, because we realize, and I think there's some concurrence, that it might not be what we would have the federal government spend money on, but it's coming to the region, and if Mesa doesn't spend it, it is going to go to Glendale or Phoenix or someplace else, because we compete for these monies and submit projects. We can say, now you go build yours over in Phoenix, and Mesa residents can drive to Phoenix if they want to use a cart path or a canal path. But I think we should do it for our community. And the money's been appropriated. I would hate to pay back $250,000. I thought the decision was made when we started that we understood that we have a master plan for canals, and this is the next section. And it was just working out the details of how we could accommodate the equestrian. So I wanted to bring this forward while this council was still seated so we could make a final decision. Because you're right, this thing got shelved, and I was disappointed it got shelved, because I wanted to let the residents know whether we wanted to do projects like this or whether we wanted to turn the money back into the region and let the projects be built in another community. So that's how I'm analyzing the final decision, and I certainly hope and appreciate the work you've done that we can move forward and get this thing done. So this is going to be on our agenda for Monday night, and I'm sure we'll hear pro and con again on Monday. But I appreciate the work the staff has done. Vice Mayor.
I have a couple of more questions. Philosophically, Mayor, I've certainly been in support of the canal system for paths, but paving versus not paving doesn't mean that the canal system isn't available for paths. And there have been areas in Phoenix that I was told are going to be maintained without paving because of the equestrian uses there. The reason this is a little bit different than some other areas is because of the structure of where the canal sits. So can we talk for a second about the canal bank, which, by the way, we've had some good cooperation with SRP, working with the neighbors and trying to do some good things that needed to be done on that canal, and we need to say that. They have really stepped forward. The neighbors worked with them, and I think you all worked with them, and I am not trying to criticize the work that you've done. You have worked very hard to try and make this work out. But there is a situation there where that bank is very steep. Who's been looking at the erosion possibilities of the bank? And I'm thinking particularly as you are coming right off of McKellop's. Boy, that's very steep. And you are looking straight down into people's backyards. That isn't going to change. You know, they bought homes knowing that there was a canal there. There is a path there. It is unpaved, but people do use it today. I will tell you, Dan, I won't be crossing McKellop's there, even with the shelter, because it may be posted at 45, but I would guess the average speeds are closer to 54. And you're coming up a hill there, and people coming down the hill there, and it would be, I do have some real concerns about it. But who's looking at the bank and the erosion of the bank and how that would be maintained? And also, has anybody looked at the privacy of the people? When you did the design on this, did you look at the privacy of the people on the south, you know, that it curves right there, but you know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. on that downside of the bank?
Yeah, I'll answer some of this. As far as the erosion on the bank, that's really the responsibility of SRP. Not that we couldn't include landscaping or some bank stabilization if that was an issue. We actually went out and drove the canal again looking. They're really, you know, in that first section just north of McKellips, there really is just one house where it, you can look right down into the backyard because of the trees. The other eight that are adjacent to that, you really can't look down, but there is one that's specifically you can look down in that's right, that backs up right to the canal. So,
I think I was at her house the other day looking at it.
Yeah.
But as you go on, there are other, I mean, you know, as you keep on going, maybe at that particular spot there's only one, but there are other places as you go along. You're just looking right down in somebody's...
Right, Mayor and Vice Mayor, the vegetation there is extremely dense, but there are some gaps that you can see through. I was amazed looking at it again. All four of us went out and looked at the canal again just to get fresh again with it. And very dense, very nice, very pleasant place to ride a bike and walk, and I'm sure to ride a horse. There are some gaps, and you can see into some properties that exist today already. We haven't heard too much about it. It's just that this proposed plan could bring some more users, so there's more opportunity. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that that condition exists today. Same with the erosion. Whether we put a path there or not, the canal bank needs to be stabilized and treated by SRP, and we don't want to make it any worse, and we do care about it.
I agree. I'm just thinking if you're looking at an investment, why would you put something that's going to then erode out under it? I mean, that would be certainly part of the engineering analysis of whether you would ever do something or not.
We'll go down the hill.
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, that feels safe.
Well, the point is,
horses are going to see
that canal's been there for...
Mr. Truitt, you have some comments?
Well, go ahead. Sorry. Right. I was going to say, that canal's been there for many, many years, and the erosion is the result of maybe 70 or 80 years worth of wear and tear. But I don't want to take that responsibility on. That's an SRP responsibility, to maintain their slope and their bank of their canal system. So.
I'm sorry. Mayor?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I did not want to convey the impression that I thought we should take on responsibility for the erosion. My point was, if you have erosion and you have put a path in, are you going to erode away an infrastructure that you just paid to put in? That was my point. Not that we should take it on, but that it should be part of an analysis about whether or not you would ever do something with it.
Mike?
I was in support of this project up until the point that it was decided the lights would go away. And that's the only reason that I'm not in support of this project. I believe that we are going to create a serious problem if this project moves forward without some type of lighting. I'm in agreement that you maybe could put small can lights in along the side of the trail that wouldn't detract. But if you got a kid coming down that hill at night and no lights, and he runs into the canal, where are we? I just feel uncomfortable with some public safety background in that situation. And it apparently that is not negotiable because you're moving forward with the recommendation of no light. Why aren't you stronger on that position?
I can answer that. I think we agree that having lights would add to the safety and security of use of the facility. Just the amount of feedback that we got from the participants involved, the neighbors, that was a compromise that we made. And we know it's a compromise, and that's something that we're willing to compromise. Other cities, Gilbert actually does this. They build asphalt paths with no lighting for their shared use path. So there's a precedent out there. Yes, we would like, for safety and security, we think it would be good to have the lights, but it was a compromise working with the neighborhood.
The problem with this is I become a neighborhood advocate because I won't support it without lights. So they went either way. What do the citizens of Mesa feel about it in an overall perspective? I'm not suggesting that we go to another vote in the city of Mesa over something that we should be able to make a decision on, but it's a real concern to me, and I've yet to have, you know, because Gilbert has it doesn't mean they're any safer. This is a remote area where a stalker could do some damage. That's just my philosophy, and I'm going to have a hard time changing it until we change that.
A stalker could do it now. It doesn't matter whether it has pavement or not. On the other hand, do we have a compromise?
Fire.
That's a fireman's perspective. Good point. Do we have a compromise?
Well, wait a minute. Are you saying firemen or? Never mind. I don't want to go there. Let me ask the question seriously. Do we have a compromise?
Well, on the lights, that's something that we as staff have compromised, one of the issues.
Do we have a compromise on the project?
I don't believe so with the Lehigh neighbors.
If the question is, can the council put it back in?
Absolutely.
That is one of the options, I think. One of the alternatives we brought forward is with lighting. We wanted to explore all the options. It's just it was the direction we got previously was to eliminate the lighting. So, but everything's still on the table as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, the problem with everything being on the table is we have not been able to get to four votes with any combination. Lights in, lights out, we get a 4-3 and nobody switches one way or the other. So our difficulty here is what is the compromise position that finally comes up with four votes? And I don't have the answer to that, so that's why it's on the agenda for Monday. We either get there or we turn $250,000 back to MAG and they reappropriate it. Okay.
I got one more question.
All right, Mr. Truitt.
Where would you put the light? Could you put it on the canal side now that you're getting down to these 3-foot points and stuff to where I think if you had low lights on the canal side of the path, they wouldn't be that visible if you came all the way across that and then had that hinge point and you went down to these people down below. I'm having a line of sight issue. Depending on how tall that light is, it may never make it to the people below.
Yeah, I can help answer that, Councilmember Truitt, Mayor. The original design had the lights right at the back slope, the slopes down towards the residences. Since we've moved the canal path over towards the canal, you know, we'd have to go back to SRP even to add the lights back in because they're not going to let us put those lights right adjacent to the canal path. And just for maintenance reasons and them getting in to do maintenance on the canal system, you know, that would be an issue. We couldn't have the lights right adjacent to the canal. We'd probably have to look at a different light altogether. That the lights that we had proposed had a shielding system where it was a direct down lighting right on the path, so we tried to not project lighting into the backyards of the
adjacent. So lighting now is somewhat problematic because now your path is nearer to the canal, and if you put your light adjacent to the path, it'd kind of be in the middle of the corridor.
Yes, correct. So lighting would be a problem.
Because of where we put the path.
Because of where we had to move the path to compromise.
Is there a way to do, I'm not an engineer, obviously, a way to do a small can light on the hillside that would identify the path, give some radiating light, but yet not be offensive on the hillside?
Yeah, to provide some light, it wouldn't meet kind of the minimum standards that we've designed to in the past, but there is a way that we could look at doing that.
That would be something I would be willing to accept for that short period through that, 1,000-foot area? I guess that's probably what we're talking about, isn't it? Or is it longer than that?
You move the path over there everywhere.
The overall length of this path is about 2.3 miles.
Where you're talking about lighter, is it the whole thing is no lights?
The whole thing right now.
Okay.
All right, we'll hear more on Monday night. Thanks for the discussion, Tom.
I was just saying maybe we could get the views of the Los Angeles HOA and the committee on this as well. It sounds like we've got about 6 sides to this one as well. So
it does. Yeah, that's what makes this job so much fun. Yeah. All right. Okay. Next we talk about the train locomotive at Pioneer Park. Hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction. Vice Mayor.
Rhett, I have a question I'd like you to address up front, and that is why you hired a consultant to look at this instead of just using somebody in-house to do it?
Mayor and Council Member Vice Mayor Walters, I think in our discussion we can bring that up, but it was actually a recommendation that was made by our Parks and Advisory Board some 2 years ago after discussion with council and so forth.
But I mean, that's it looking at it, but why not use somebody in-house? Why go outside? What was the decision that drove getting somebody outside instead of just using somebody in?
We had nobody internally that had experience in restoration of the train. We do have folks that, you know, work with asbestos and so forth, but in terms of cosmetic restoration of a steam locomotive, we did not have but anyone internally to do that.
That's what I needed to know. Thank you.
Great. If I could, and I know our eyes are getting glazed over, and hopefully we can move through this topic relatively quickly, I'd like to introduce Scott Fouché, who is with me, who represents environmental programs, and I think it's appropriate to also recognize that we have two members of our Parks and Advisory Board here. They've been patiently sitting through today's meeting. We have our chairman, or Madam Chairman, Connie Goulet, and our Vice Chair, Russ Gillard, here today. Many of you are familiar with the train, so I'm not going to go into a lot of details other than that this particular train is almost 100 years old. It was given to the city in 1957 as an art exhibit. As you can see from these pictures, that the train, and of course these pictures were taken in 2006, some year and a half, 2 years ago, you can see that the train is obviously severely rusted. It has been stripped of all of its gauges. Graffiti is a continuous problem. And in 1992, we placed a fence around the train for safety hazards, and has now become the home of, I think, a dozen feral cats that are living inside of that. Our primary concern with the train, as you can see, the picture of the boiler here on the train is that it is contaminated with lead paint and asbestos inside of the boiler. In 1992, this train did not meet the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission standards for playground equipment, thus the fence. At that point, Arizona Railroad Museum proposed moving this train to Chandler, to Tumbleweed Park, their museum located there. Council did not support that recommendation in 1992. In 2006, moving forward, an offer to purchase a locomotive was received by the city. And again, at that same time, the Arizona Railroad Museum of Chandler came forward with the proposal to locate or to move the train to its location in Chandler. Due to these competing interests, an RFP was issued, the notice of sale suspended due to negative community feedback. This was then taken back to the Parks Board, this issue. The Parks Board, at this point, Vice Mayor Walters, is when the consultant came into the picture. It was recommended that we hire this consultant to come up and provide professional options as to what to do with this locomotive. The city then retained Steam Operations Corporation to conduct this cosmetic restoration survey. The consultant came...
Okay. Is the cosmetic restoration survey different than the consultant coming up with the options?
It's the same.
Okay, because, I mean, you know, a monkey with a typewriter could come up with those options given enough time. I don't know why we needed to have a consultant come up with those options. But was the consultant just used to come up with, this is what, based upon my expertise, this is what needs to be done to this locomotive in order to make it usable?
Mayor and Councilmember Rawls, I think when we look at these options, it'll probably answer that question, because, yes, we could come up with the options, but we didn't know the details behind those options. For an example, how much would it cost to move the train or
okay, so that's what when I read the backup material and it said we hired a consultant to come up with these options, I went, you know, it took me about 15 minutes to scrape myself off the ceiling, because shouldn't have spent a dime to do that.
No, and we obviously had these options. We just didn't have the details behind them of how much
so
it would cost.
He provided the monetary details, the fiscal analysis. How much did the consultant cost?
I think it was $8,000.
What was it?
$4,000.
Okay, because I knew it didn't come to the council for approval. Okay.
Then,
all right. I'm now sliding way down the wall, so I appreciate that because.
No, that's a fair question, and I'll just briefly explain his options here, because obviously the first one, he also is aware of individuals that purchase these trains and has that expertise, and who could possibly, we could send an RFP to. That was his first option, which was to sell the locomotive.
I have another question on that option. Why an RFP as opposed to a for sale sign?
I think any time we're selling a city asset like that, that we have to take it out, explain what we're trying to do, and then allow everybody the opportunity to bid on it. So it's really no different than a for sale sign. It's just the process to go through to get people interested in the sale of it. Or buying it.
Okay, but we're not trying to say, okay, you have to use it, and we're not going to give points for their ultimate use of it or
it's basically
ultimate location. Price is going to be the only criteria.
Well, Councilman, I think what we would specify in something like this is things like liability. They're responsible for picking up, transporting it, recognizing the condition of it, that it may have asbestos. They'll be responsible for it. I think that's what, when we term RFP, that would include those conditions.
We're basically talking about this option is to sell it as is, where is, cost us nothing.
Right.
You buy it, you move it,
it's
you
yours.
Restore it, you do whatever you want with it. Again, I don't want to generate a lot of staff time if this is the option that's chosen. So I was just trying to make sure we weren't, you know, it's kind of like some of our other sales where we tell people what they have to do with the property. We're just, okay.
They can't use it for a pawn shop.
They can't use it for a pawn shop, but the massage parlor is fine. Okay.
Option number
two.
He said a check cashing store was okay.
Option number two was one that had already been surfaced, and that was to, again, relocate it to Chandler, thus keeping it at least in Arizona or in the region. This did come with a cost of $3,000 to the city of Mesa. I think the total cost to transport that would be $45,000, but the proposal that Chandler or that this museum had offered would that the city would have to pick up $30,000 worth of that relocation cost. And then option number three, and Councilmember Rawls, this is where we got into the details that he provided when he looked at the insulation or the asbestos and lead abatement. He examined the train, came up with an original estimate of $40,000 to $60,000 to abate that. Number two, and again, these could be done in phases. The cosmetic restoration he estimated at $160,000, and then again the relocation of it. He suggested that if we were to do phase one and two, that it be moved to a more prominent location within the park for a total estimated cost of $240,000 to $260,000. It's important to note that this was done in 2006. Since that time, we've had others examine the train in terms of asbestos and try to contain that. These numbers, and he, the consultant, also stated that these would increase 10 to 15% each year based upon the rust and so forth. So the new number for number one, the abatement is now $100,000 to $150,000. The cosmetic restoration is now at $185,000, and the relocation to $45,000 for a total increase of $90,000 since the original report. To bring you to 2007, this report was presented to the Parks and Advisory Board, at which time they recommended a three-tier approach. The first was to form a citizens' fundraising committee to raise funds for this restoration. If that was unsuccessful, they suggested that $30,000 be raised and move the train to the Arizona Railroad Museum as the second alternative. If that was to fail and $30,000 was unobtainable, then three, to move forward with an RFP to sell the train. A recent alternative after that meeting came forward, which was to seek federal arts grants funding to restore and relocate the locomotive to a future transit station in Mesa. And, of course, this comes with, it's dependent upon the approval of the Mesa LRT extension, and of course this is not likely to take place until 2011. These recommendations were presented to the Community and Neighborhood Services Committee seeking their input. This committee recommended after much discussion that this be brought back to the entire council, as they were split on their decision. Thus the reason we're here today. And to just bring you completely up to speed, just within the last few weeks, we have, and Scott's team, Environmental Programs, has initiated a temporary process to stabilize the asbestos due to some concerns that we have with that. And it has not been done as of today, but that estimate will be approximately $11,000 and could stabilize at least the boiler portion of that project or that problem for at least 2 years. So with that, we're seeking your direction on the following four options. The first option would be to issue a request for proposal for the sale of the locomotive. We need to consider that there could be possible revenue from the sale and no additional maintenance cost to the city. Number two would be to develop a long-term lease with the Arizona Railroad Museum to restore and house the train at Tumbleweed Park in Chandler. For this consideration, it would we would need to realize $30,000 expenditure to relocate it, and then after that, no additional cost to the city of Mesa. Number three would be to form a citizens fundraising committee based upon the Parks Advisory Board a recommendation to restore and to keep the locomotive here in Mesa. We must consider, though, when the Parks Board made that recommendation, it was $90,000 less than these figures. These are new and updated numbers. So now that committee must raise $330,000 up to $380,000. And again, their recommendation was within a set time frame. Parks Board recommended 6 months. And that every year goes by, these would increase by 10% to 15%. And finally, number four, research the federal funding sources to restore the locomotive as a public art project in conjunction with the light rail transit system. And as I mentioned, these come with the fact that it's dependent upon the light rail being extended, as well as we could not, we probably would not have that answer until 2011. So with that, Mayor and Council members, we're here to answer any questions or lead the discussion, but these are the four options that are before you.
Good. Mr. Truitt, what's your solution?
I have no solution. I have questions.
Okay.
Did they ever give you a ballpark idea if you put out an RFP what the value might be on the street?
We have, as I mentioned, three folks that have voiced interest. One did throw out a monetary figure, and they offered $5,000, but they would relocate it and restore it, and all of that would be there. So it would be a net gain to the city of $5,000. That's the only one that I'm aware of.
Okay, so it's really a zero-cost alternative. The second question I have is if we looked at this as a community asset, could we go out and buy a train, put it here, that was in good condition, and put it here for significantly less than $330,000.
Mayor, Council members, Council Member Truitt, I don't have the answer to that. I don't know. I think there's historic value to this train, and that's in sentimental value. So I don't know if we would accomplish that goal by just getting any ordinary train or.
I'm not talking about an ordinary train, but I'm just saying, is this one in such a situation that the investment might not be. Have the same benefit as of finding another 80 or 100-year-old train that was in good condition that somebody's bought for $5,000 and restored. Yep. Same guys that we're selling it to. You know, they might restore that sucker and come back and sell it to you for $150,000 a year from now.
And I could find that out, but I do not have the answer to that.
Okay. And my last question is, if somebody spends $350,000 in restoring it, does the fence come down and can my grandkids then climb on the train again?
The way it would have to be restored, basically they would not be able to climb on the train, but the fence would be able to come down because they wouldn't, the lead paint and the asbestos and so forth would be removed, but they would not be able to climb on it. There'd have to be some sort of a system to keep them off of it.
I suppose. Yes. We're so litigious.
Since I was being a smart guy, I might as well keep going. I just wanted to frame out this option number four here. Are we estimating that the cost will increase 10 to 15% annually as we wait to find out if we extend the light rail, if we're going to use this project, and if there's going to be any federal funding for arts around this? What do we estimate that cost is going to be by the end of this time? $300,000?
Yeah, 20% more than it is now.
20% more than it is now. And how much is the federal government given to arts?
And I'll have
thus
to
far, per mile, I suppose. Because this would be, I would think this would be a significant expense for what would equate to about 3 or 4 miles of light rail track
station.
I think I can answer a little bit on that.
We've spent all of the station stops, I think there's 23 or 24. What's the allocation per station stop for the artwork component?
It's around, it depends on city because each city did a little bit different, but it's, if I'm thinking back right, it was a 1% of the total budget broken out, and I believe it was from 110 to 150 or 160 thousand per station. To answer the question about the available funding, the federal government, if we were to get a federal match on high capacity transit, doesn't matter what mode it is, light rail, BRT, whatever, they would match 50% of the art funding that we could come up with. So it would be a 50% match from the federal government.
All right, so we wouldn't be recovering all the costs of, we would incur some fairly significant costs for restoring this and moving it to one of the stops later on.
Yeah.
If we were to do this option anyway. And what would we have to do between now and 2011 just to stabilize the problem so that it doesn't get any worse between now and 2011?
Councilmember Summers, that would be the $11,000 that Environmental Services could do in spraying some different components inside the boiler and around that. So $11,000.
So just holding the thing together with a spray-on glue, I suppose. And then we have to scrape that off to fix it. I love that. On option two, you say it's a lease to the Arizona Railway Museum. Would we be receiving any annual payment for the lease, or would it be a lease for free?
No, it basically just be a long-term lease that we would give that was their proposal, that we would just lease that over to them.
Right. So it would cost us $30,000. We lease it for $0, and we end up incurring the cost of $30,000.
Okay. Right. Vice Mayor.
Thank you. I don't understand the lease. Why wouldn't we just give it to them? I mean, that's kind of a...
No, we would. I'm sorry, I don't...
Why would we lease it to them as opposed to giving it to them?
Oh, and there's, I don't know, I guess we could look in that. When we talked to some individuals, they preferred that it be leased over because it was still a city asset, but we could work through that and give it to them, I guess.
Well, so they can give it back.
That was the thought that I had. That was exactly what I thought. I thought, okay, so then it deteriorates and now it's our asset again and we have to do something. But let me just say that this has been a... This is an incredibly emotional issue for people. I talk to people who are my age who recall playing on it and claim that they have brain damage today as a result of having licked the paint or something on the on here before we knew anything about lead-based paint. I just said long before we ever knew there was such a... I'm sorry, the statute of limitations for people my age, Debbie, has long since expired, even though I claim to be 29. It is true that I am not 29. But this is an emotional issue for people, and I think that the Parks Board did a good job of trying to take that into account by giving their series of recommendations to allow the community to try and raise the money if they'd like to. I had one person who proposed that everybody who had ever climbed on the train should donate a dollar. And one guy said, a dollar for every time I climbed on the train? I thought we were going to get the $330,000 from him alone. But I thought that the recommendations of the Parks Board really reflected the fact that there was a lot of community interest, love, history, that there are certain symbols in our community that for us mean something. And we recognize that the city doesn't have the money to do this. But if people want to privately raise the money, I think we ought to give them the option of trying that. I don't really see why that's a downside. So, you know, when they went through this, I guess I don't get to the place where the city should spend $30,000 for the railway museum. I don't see us coming up with a $30,000. But if they wanted to raise that money privately, you know, if they only get to a fundraising goal of $30,000 and then it goes to the railway museum as opposed to getting enough to restore the whole thing, that's another direction to go. But I thought that the Parks Board recommendation was pretty good here, Mayor.
Okay, let's see if we can get to four and move on with this. I'm going to support the Parks recommendation also to give the attempt to try to raise the funding independently. I know that's going to cost us $11,000 to stabilize, which bothers me some. But my other option would be to do an out-and-out sale unless something else comes back up. But I think let's give it the attempt. It's going to be a little more difficult to structure the fundraising because I would assume they'd want to fundraise for the full restoration. And if they only get to 30, they're going to want to say, well, if we didn't do full restoration, we'll have to give that money back and then do a separate fundraising almost to say, should we send it down to Chandler and raise $30,000 so you can drive down there to see it? So you really have several campaigns, and I don't know how they overlap or how you fill out a form for somebody to indicate either or, first preference, second. But I like the idea of letting the community see if there is an interest. To me, there's not. I'd say if it was just my decision, I'd say sell it. Get it off the city's hands. It's more of a liability than it's worth. But there may be a community faction out there that really wants this thing restored and is willing to come up with the money, and I'd like to give them that option. So that would be mine, Mr. Truitt.
If they raise the money and the train is restored, what is the long-term maintenance obligations then of the city? Because we're going to continue to maintain it. They're going to restore it once. They're going to get rid of the asbestos, but you're going to continue to paint it and do other things so that it doesn't continue to rust.
Good point.
Obviously, with the abatement of the asbestos and the lead paint being gone, a lot of the maintenance issues would be done away with. However, you know, there would still be annual painting and upkeep of it. I think Councilmember Summers brings up a good point that we, during this campaign, would need to educate the folks that it will never be like it was when they played on it, in the sense of you simply can't have kids playing on a steam engine anymore. It's just too much liability. So it'll be a something to view, not touch and feel.
Right. Okay, so we've got two, say, parks recommendation. Let's see if we can get to a conclusion on this one. Tom?
My preference is to sell it or give it away if somebody will take it without any cost to us. But I also think if the consensus of the council is to go the citizens fundraising route, that also should include the $11,000 to stabilize it. I don't think the city should spend another dime to maintain this in our community. So my preference is to sell it, but I would ask those, if there's a consensus in the other way, to raise that money for that as well.
First $11,000 goes to stabilize. If you don't get it in a short period of time, you sell it. I mean, so you'd have a progressive order. Well, and if you get the whole amount, then you restore it and move it to another location.
Yeah, let's just be clear, because I'm not sure I heard. That's what I heard. We feel like we have to spend the $11,000 now, right, just kind of on an almost at emergency basis because of what's happening with the structure, and certainly with all the rain that's taking place.
Correct.
We just want to be careful that there's not any concerns about, I mean, and frankly, by not doing that now, it'll only make the cost, even more costs, of a challenge in the future, I think. So, if we can go ahead and spend the $11,000 now.
The $11,000 still is the first $11,000 raised by the citizens reimburses the city for that, because if we sell it tomorrow, we don't have to pay that $11,000.
If I can answer that, Mayor Hockley or Councilmember Rawls, the condition of the sheet metal on the boiler presently is really in a condition that I would use the word friable, is what they use in asbestos. You could literally put a finger through some portions of that sheet metal right now. So it's our opinion that needs to be done in order for it even to be moved. My concern would be once we begin moving the train that we would have some of that sheet metal come off or deteriorate in chunks, and you would have asbestos going down.
Is it a health hazard if nobody can get to it to put their finger through it?
Just with the condition that it's in now.
Not moving it, just keeping it locked up in its little fence.
Right, but just with the elements, the weather, the wind, the possibility, high winds during a storm event, it's my opinion that it could be damaged in sheet metal and or the patches that have been placed there over the years could fall off, and we could have a problem with asbestos going into the park. That's why we have recommended to move forward with the stabilization.
All right.
Councilmember Rawls, though, if I understand your point, if it's $330,000 to restore this train, if we go out to a fundraising committee, then we would give the number of $341,000, an additional $11,000, and then that would be technically reimbursed for this project, and then the balance would go towards the restoration?
Because, again, my view, if there's somebody who's offered us $5,000, we have three people who have made contact with us. You know, if we get offers from them today and tell them, you know, it's going to cost you $11,000 to stabilize it before you can move it, then it's $11,000 the city doesn't have to spend. So if I'm not going to get my way on selling it, then I think the people who are responsible for not selling it and incurring that $11,000 fee should cover it.
That includes the move to Chandler then, so it's going to be $41,000. You'd have to spend the 11 plus the additional 30 later, so that would be the total, right? Scott?
Well, I there was a comment made about the 11,000 having to stabilize it just to move it. We wouldn't have to spend that money. If we're going to sell this outright, that's part of the moving expense. Yeah, so
you wouldn't incur that $11,000.
Right. That goes on to whoever purchases it. That's
exactly right. You know, as is, where is.
Absolutely.
Again, Council, we can do that. I think the concern staff had is that we were moving forward under the presumption that we need to spend $11,000 irregardless of which option is being considered. It is a condition that is concerning us today, not whether even something happens under any one of these options. It was the concern that I think the material may fall off and somehow move away, migrate through, well, I guess, rain or wind out of the security of the fence and into the park. That was the concern of the plan to spend the $11,000 today.
Still, if you have the $11,000 as part of the RFP, then you're going to recover that, even if we had to spend it today. I might have to spend it now, but I'm going to recover it as part of the RFP. Would I not?
Most of the offers may be, we'll take it from you.
Well, we'd
thank you very
to
much. And that's about the end of the transaction.
I have no. We can figure out how we get the $11,000 back, but I'm okay. It's my opinion is I'm okay spending that $11,000 to take care of the problem. I'm willing to give some time for a volunteer group to raise some money to see if they can either restore it or pay to move it, but the $11,000 has to be included. I'd also ask that we know who that group's going to be, if we actually have a group that's going to do that. I don't want to assume that we do. And also, we got to have a time frame. You know, are we going to make it 3 months, 6 months, a year, and know what, you know, if it's going to be a 6 months, is $11,000 going to take care of it? Or are we going to have to spend more money later on? To give them this time, I want to know that $11,000 is going to buy us the time, the stability, whatever, try to raise the money, set a date, end that date, and move it. Right. And then go to sell after that.
As long as it's after June 2nd?
I object to that particular.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
I move that we put Keno Hawker in charge of the... actually, I had some of the same questions that Scott just had. Has there been anybody who has stepped forward who wants to kind of spearhead doing this fundraising for this?
No, obviously there's been people that have been concerned about it and so forth, but nobody's come forward to our office and said that they want to lead that charge.
Okay, well, I think we need to, and I'm sorry, friends from the Parks Board, but I think we need to send this back to the Parks Board to work on finding out whether or not there is any entity like that. Because absent that, the council, and we can't ask staff to go out and find somebody to do it. I mean, it's great for the community to say, we want to step up, we want to do this, but somebody's going to have to step up and do it. So Connie, I think it's going to have to come back to your board to look at that. And if there isn't someone, then we need to move forward. But based on what I'm hearing from Environmental Services, it sounds like we need to do stabilization right away. You know, that's something that we have to do regardless. And whether or not we can recoup it later on the sale, I'm wondering if somebody's offering you $5,000 and they're already planning on the moving costs, if they've factored in an additional $11,000, if they're now saying, yeah, I'm not even talking to you anymore. But, you know, we'll have to see on that one. But I think that part of this is going to have to be Mayor sending it back to the Parks Board for them to determine whether or not this is just wonderful talk in the community. People want to see it happen. They want somebody to do it. But nobody wants to be the somebody to do it.
Okay. Let's see if we can get to four. I know that
okay.
My alternative, I don't know why, rather sending it back to the Parks Board, if we made a motion that just says, this is a call to the public, you've got 30 days to come forward, have a group formed and raise $10,000 to show us that you're honest, or we're going to put it up for sale. You know, why go back to the Parks Board and then have them look around and whatever? You know, it's a public meeting, and just say, if there's some of you out here that are listening to this and they're really concerned, form your group and act in a reasonable time, 30 days, 45 days. That would be that's my feeling.
Mike?
When we had the committee, I indicated that I felt that we probably should just cut the loss and sell this. I've been a Mesa since 1961. My kids have played on this thing. The problem with fixing it the way we're going to fix it is that kids can never play on it. I mean, that's what its intent was, and, you know, to climb up and get in the cab and do all that stuff. We're never going to be able to do that, and having children to look at, it's not a big deal to them. Oh, yeah, there's a train. If they can't touch, feel, or taste it, which kids like to do, it's not going to be, worthwhile. There's a lot of things in this community I would wish the Parks Board would go after to raise funds for. A lot of youth programs that we've had to cut. I'm not telling you what to do, but if I'm looking at where the money is best spent, cut our losses and go home. This is not what Mesa is. This has no historical reference to Mesa in reality. It was brought here. It was going to the scrap heap in 1957. We saved it for a long time. I think it's time to let it go.
All right. Does anybody have an idea on where we are for consensus to move forward? Because I don't have the sense that we're there.
No, I think you're missing.
Okay. So how do we get there so we can give direction?
I was going to try a motion.
I think we may need to do some votes then on it.
I was going to try a motion, and let me explain why I'm saying for it to go to the Parks Board. I'm not saying go to the Parks Board, then come back to us, then come back. I'm saying that we have a citizens committee that has looked at this and has you know, some interest in it, and that they would then be the people who would take that input, rather than it's coming back to us, have them be the people who are taking the input, not us. I'm fine with what I'm going to make a motion is that we send this out to the community with if you are interested in doing this, and Mike, you may be right, but I think that the thing that we have been asked to do is to give the community the chance to say whether or not it's important to them. And I think they're going to say whether or not it's important to them by whether or not they step up with the dollars for it or not. So my motion is that we give a period of time, and I think we need to give more than 30 days. First of all, my motion includes the stabilization of this, because I think regardless of what happens, we have to take care of that for safety reasons, for liability reasons. So that's the first piece of it. The second piece of it is that we give it 60 days, that we send it back to the Parks Board for the board to put out a call to the community and say if anybody's interested and wants to do this, that they need to come back. And I think a reasonable, I'd like them to discuss what that reasonable amount of money is. I'm thinking, you know, in 60 days, raising $10,000 would be a lot of money in 60 days, but because of how long it takes to get the word out, and so an initial fundraising of $10,000 in that 60-day period of time might indicate some significant interest. But then I think we need to set a time, an end point of when that money would need to be raised. And I'd like to look again to the Parks Board for what would be reasonable there. I'm thinking like maybe a year of time to raise that money, but have to meet some deadlines in terms of dollars along the way. But that's why I wanted to go back to the Parks Board, because to set those time frames without having some serious discussion about what that means, I don't want to sit up here for the next hour and discuss, you know, how much time that's going to take. So my motion is for it to go back to them. And then the second piece would be, do you want to go to the second spot? Because the second spot for me is not for us to spend $30,000, unless the money is raised to give it to Chandler. My second place is to sell it. If the money's raised to take it to Chandler, then I'm okay with that, but I'm not going to come up with the $30,000 to take it to Chandler. How's that for a motion, Daryl? Did I capture it? Well, then if I don't have a second, it doesn't go anywhere.
Is there a second? I'll go ahead and second it so we can have a vote on this one. Further discussion on the motion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Nay.
All right. Other suggestion? Do you want to try to sell?
I'll make a motion that we sell it.
Right. Second.
All right. Motion and second to sell. Any discussion? All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Nay.
Nay. All right. Let's try again.
Try a motion.
I'll make another motion. We can do half sales tax and half property tax.
What about my motion for Keno to be in charge of the fundraising? Where did that go?
All right. Mr. Truitt.
Well, mine's going to be like Claudia's. My motion would be that we spend the $11,000, that we go ahead and just put the call out to the public. And I'm okay with giving them 60 days to see some sort of organized committee. I don't mind if that committee wants to go report to the Parks Commission, to Parks Board, and say that they're formed and that they've raised. I don't think asking them to raise $10,000 when you're asking them to go to 300 and some odd thousand is a bad target for 60 days. If there's really people out there, I don't want to give them 60 days to decide if they're interested. They can do that in a week or two and decide that they're interested, and I think we give them a target. If they don't meet the target, they raise $8,000, then we'll decide. But you know what I mean? Let's give them a target. $10,000, raise it in 60 days, and if not, then we go forward with, part of my motion would be go forward and sell it. If there isn't the interest, if the interest doesn't come forward, there's not an organized group, and they raise $10,000 in 60 days, then part of my motion is that if that doesn't happen, we would go forward and sell it.
Okay, so the difference between the two is instead of maybe going to a year, 60 days.
I think if they demonstrate the fact that they can.
60 days.
60 days, $10,000 was in my first motion. Yes. I'm sorry that was not there.
And back to Parks
Board. And back to the Parks Board, so we didn't have to deal with it.
I didn't hear the time frame set in there.
I didn't hear that. I didn't quite understand it.
I did.
I'm sorry.
But part of my motion is if it doesn't happen in 60 days, we sell it, period.
All right. Anybody else? Motion and second discussion, Mike.
Where does the money go if they only raise $10,000?
I'll let that group. That's the group's problem.
That's their problem. Okay. Is the first $10,000 towards reimbursing the city? Is that part of the deal?
I don't want to muddy that up. Let's just see if there's real genuine interest. The idea is, what is there genuine interest? Can they organize themselves if there really is that interest and demonstrate it?
Yeah. And report back to the committee, back to us by 60 days.
Yeah.
Okay. Motion second.
Report to us or report to the Parks Board? Do we need to take this again?
I think probably.
Well, I think you have to eventually take it. It's a city asset. It's not the Parks Board. I don't think can decide on the asset.
Well, I agree with that.
Okay. So 60 days back to council, see if there's the action is then.
Okay. I don't know what the calendar looks like, but the first study session in April, that's 2 months. That's essentially 60 days. I mean, let's be specific if you're going to do it. Because 60 days tends to get vague out there, and
okay,
that turns
that
into 67, and then it turns
I'd amend
into
my motion
90.
To the first study session in April.
All right.
I guess it was 63 days.
Well, where's February?
Here's my question to the motion maker. Daryl, the reason I wanted it to go to the Parks Board was because they have had conversations with the community. Who are we turning it over to staff and saying to staff, now you go out and find out if there's interest? That's why I thought that this set of volunteers.
Turning it over to Mr. Nelson.
Gary's going to put it in the paper, but who's the point of contact? Is there a point of contact at the city?
60 days from now.
So what we're expecting is that there will be a spontaneous generation of interest in the community. That
I'm looking for that groundswell support, I suppose.
And what we could do to offer, I mean, we can put our phone number out there right now. They could call 644-3440, and those that are interested or are wanting to be a part of that.
Brett, I think the question from the vice mayor is, what if you have multiple interested parties at different levels? Where can they go to kind of get it organized and decide who's going to be the lead and who's going to organize it?
You think the Parks Board's going to do that for them?
Well, at least there gives a forum. Parks Board meets on a regular basis. They're going to meet in between. It would allow them maybe to at least visit with those who are interested and get them organized. We could do that as staff. I think that was just the question. Where's the appropriate kind of response to help sort through who's going to be the lead and who are all the interested parties?
don't think you have enough faith in the railroad enthusiasts to not form their own group to support this thing. But that's been the standing pattern. Yes, Scott.
What's to stop the Parks Board from meeting in 1 week from now to help coordinate this?
I think that's
the point. Let them do that, but it has to come back to this council
in 60 days.
Yes, I agree.
I'm fine with that.
I don't care how they go about it. Somebody come back in 60 days.
Call the question.
April 3rd, Mayor.
No.
April 3rd?
We don't do
okay. See, it comes back to the council on April 3rd. If at least $10,000 has not been raised, then we'll have a discussion. And I think, is your motion include and sell it at that point?
My motion would include that we then sell it if that doesn't occur.
Sell it for whatever we can get on the market if the $10,000 minimum has not been raised.
And my motion was to also go do the $11,000 remedial repair.
Right. Okay. All right. Is that clear on the motion? And the second? Concurs? All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
Nay.
Nay. So that one does get to four. So there are four with two nays with Tom and Mike voting nay.
Great. Thank you.
All right.
Can I explain my vote?
Assume you wanted to just sell.
My father was a railroad man. I do have a lot of faith in the railroad, but that's the reason.
So is my grandfather. All right. Okay, next, here reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Any updates, reports? MAG Regional Council met last night. I will be chair of the Transportation Policy Committee until my term expires. So that got voted in. Nothing else?
Congratulations.
Yeah. Number six, scheduling of meetings and general information. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Reminder to those on the Community Neighborhood Services Committee meeting, you have a meeting right after this today. And then we are also having a presentation and tour today at the Gateway, Mesa Gateway Administration Building in the boardroom. That'll start at 1 p.m. To review some of the aviation-related discussions, concerns relating to the airport, as well as a tour of the GM Proving Grounds and the ASU Polytechnic Campus. That'll begin at 1 p.m. in the administration building at the airport. And our next council meeting is February 4th. We'll probably have an early study or early start date or start time, because we do have a few executive session items as well as the follow-up on the discussion about Parcel 51. And also, we are anticipating that on Thursday, February 7th, that study session will most likely be canceled, but there will be a General and Economic Development Committee meeting. We have a few council members who are out that day. So the suggestion is to go ahead, though, with the General and Economic Development Committee, and the chairman preference for start, if we don't have the study session, would be 8 o'clock. We'll do it at 8 o'clock then. On the 7th.
I know I'm one out of them. Am I on that committee or who's on that committee?
All right.
I'm not on that committee.
You may have received an invitation already, but from the Public Safety Committee, the Police Department Annual Awards Banquet is Friday, February 29th, so you got that on your calendars if you can make it.
Okay. And are there any requests to speak?
No requests, Mayor.
All right. Motion second to adjourn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
To adjourn.